All right. I want to welcome everyone to the House Interim Committee on Human Services and Housing. Today is January 14th, 2016. Thank you for joining us. And we are going to start with a report from Housing and Community Services Director Margaret Van Vliet. And Dr. Richardson from DHS. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Van Vliet. I am the director of the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. Very glad to be here with you today. I've got a few remarks, and then I'll share the microphone with Dr. Richardson. As you, I think, know, the housing need in Oregon has never been more severe. Across really the entire spectrum, from people who are homeless or at risk of losing their homes, to renters surviving but becoming more rent burdened, and homeowners struggling to avoid foreclosure because their income still has not recovered from the recession, really every segment of our housing market shows signs of distress. In Multnomah County, some 300 people showed up Saturday at the Chair's Forum to tell legislators how bad it's getting, and it's certainly not just Portland. I'm aware that in Corvallis and Bend and Lincoln City and Eugene and Klamath Falls and elsewhere, local leaders are digging deep to find solutions to the crisis they are experiencing. And I want to share today just a few data points that confirm how difficult the housing market is for Oregonians, particularly those with low incomes. But the stories we're all hearing from real people affected by the housing crisis really are more compelling. But a few data points. Statewide, the number of people in poverty jumped almost 60% since the year 2000, from 226,000 to 615,000 Oregonians. And a startling 34% of all Oregonians experiencing poverty are non-whites. That's more than 200,000 Oregonians of color, and it represents a disproportionately high number of people of color. At our last homeless count, some 14,000 Oregonians were considered homeless. We do this count every year. We'll do it again the end of this month with our community partners. Foreclosure filings and mortgage delinquencies remain above pre-recession levels. Lenders filed 82,000 foreclosure notices for the first 10 months of 2015. Now, that's down from what we saw in 2014, but still a huge number of Oregonians affected by foreclosure. Statewide, the median home price has gone up 34% in 5 years. We know that in certain markets like Bend and Portland, they saw much faster growth. And of course, housing price appreciation is good for many in society, but it's also an indicator of the rapid rise in real estate prices generally, including rents. Apartment construction in Portland and Bend is up considerably, as are residential building permits generally. And while I don't have precise data today on this, we believe that only a small fraction of the new construction will be affordable to low-income people. Building permits for nearly 7,000 residential units were issued in Portland in 2015. And it goes on and on. You've heard me say that one of the strategic objectives of my redesigned department is to become data and research driven. We have taken big steps in that direction this year, and I'm pleased to be able to share with you our newly published poverty report. There's a link to this in OLIS. And I will be happy to deliver a hard copy to any of your offices if you'd like it. It's a county-by-county look at a variety of statistics around poverty, unemployment, housing burdens, and other important trends that people can use to make decisions and think about planning work. We used to do this every other year with our friends at the Community Action Partnership of Oregon. It had been a number of years since we published it, so we're pleased to be able to reinstate that. And I think you'll find it a useful tool. Another of our strategic objectives for OHCS's alignment is integration. And it's in this context that I'm pleased that Dr. Richardson from DHS has joined me. State agencies are trying hard to bust through their silos, and the intersection of self-sufficiency and housing stability is arguably one of the most critical integration pieces of work we can do. We are explicitly working together to design how the $40 million LIFT program will work, but are eager to move beyond that and deepen our collaboration even further. So with that, I'd like to ask Dr. Richardson to make a few remarks.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Kinney-Geyer and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dr. Reginald Richardson. I'm the new director of the Office of Self-Sufficiency Programs for the Oregon Department of Human Services. I want to endorse our housing director's comments about our agency's deepening collaboration. As you know, DHS and housing share many clients, and we share a vision to address poverty through family stability. Affordable, safe, sustainable housing is critical for low-income families to work their way out of poverty and a dependence on public assistance programs and move to self-reliance and economic stability. When the incredible stress of finding and keeping a family sheltered is taken off the plate, the families we serve in self-sufficiency have the capacity to address family issues then. Parents have a better chance of participating in job preparation programs, children have a better chance at being successful in schools, and families are much healthier. That's why we value so much our partnership with housing and our role in the LIFT program. A safe, stable, affordable home can be the launching pad for self-sufficiency participants to become self-supporting, contributing members of our local communities.
So with respect to the LIFT program, I can report strong progress on the part of our stakeholder committee process. Now, as you'll recall, the source of funds, Article 11Q bonds, includes a requirement that the state own or operate the asset that gets financed. And you may also recall that we've been working to secure guidance from Legislative Council and the Department of Justice about what that should look like, as the underlying questions and answers will strongly influence how we structure transactions and the state investment, and how we think about the role of my agency and best ways to engage the private sector actors. Now that we have some of what we need about that legal guidance, we can put more details into our draft program design. This week, the two committees that are advising us met. They made really good progress, and I'm anticipating them coming back to you next month for a fuller discussion of our draft program design. Our current rollout schedule has a solicitation or invitation to bid later in the spring, selecting projects early fall, and selling bonds to move the projects forward next spring, 15 months from now. We do expect projects to be complete in 2018, and our stakeholders and advisors are cautioning us to balance our desire for speed and efficiency with our policy goals of really doing the right projects. We are striving for balance and meeting multiple complex expectations, but I think we're finding some really good pathways to manage those trade-offs. I also want to say a quick word about the mental health housing investment, the $20 million in lottery-backed bonds that were appropriated to my agency for mental health housing. Similar stakeholder process, similar collaboration with the Oregon Health Authority in designing that program so that the target populations get access to the housing we create with those resources. On another subject, in November, I updated you on our allocation of document recording fee. Now, as part of the materials you have in OLIS, I've provided another brief update that reflects projects awarded new funds out of the document recording fee funds in December. We excerpted a few slides out of the presentation we gave to the State Housing Council, and so you can get a flavor for where the projects are and what the scale of those investments looks like. I'm pleased that the backlog of funding awards has been corrected. We're making good progress addressing the problems we talked with you about in the last session. With funding from our agency, I'm pleased to tell you that thousands of new affordable housing units are currently under construction. And when the December financials close for my agency, we will true up those county-by-county numbers, and I'd be happy to bring that back to you in February. But I'm feeling very good and very hopeful about the progress we've made, as I've said. Now, all of this work will continue to benefit from policy guidance of the Housing Stability Council. The revised role of the policy and governance body became effective January 1st, and the seven existing members of the council are already asking deeper questions and gaining a broader view of the totality of the work of OHCS and how it all ties together. It's my understanding that Governor Brown will be making two new appointments in May to bring the total roster to 9 people. Those appointments, of course, require some confirmation, and I'll be happy to update this committee and bring the chair and other members as that is useful and helpful to the deliberations of this committee. In closing, I want to thank you again for your leadership, for your attention to this very critical issue. I know you have a full agenda today, so I'll end there, but be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that presentation. Are there questions from the committee? I want to make a comment. Since you're here, this is your opportunity to ask questions about the LIFT program. And you may recall that that bill had gone through our committee, I believe it was 2198 last year. Because it had some exposure here and none in the Senate, it's going to actually start on the Senate side. So that was one of our three committee bills that we had drafted, but the decision was made to actually introduce it on the Senate side, which is why we are down to two committee bills, which is fine because we have a lot of work. But I want to make sure that if you do have any questions about the LIFT program now or in the future, it will be starting there and we'll be seeing it later.
I do have a comment.
Yep.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to thank you for the report. But, you're talking about balance. I would encourage us to, if we're going to err on the side of being aggressive about solving the issues and less concerned about balance, I guess. Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, actually, and I know that your report about the NOFA, Notice of Funds Available Awards, are on OLIS, and you have a graph that I wondered if you could just, anyone can see it if they've got OLIS in front of them, but you have the statewide allocation, what you've gotten out the door, GHAP, HDGP, OAHTC,
LI. Oh, yes.
Could you just run through those?
Because
I think... Yes. It will be, we were so anxious to get money out the door, and you have been getting money out the door, and I think it'll be very satisfying, at least to me and probably to others of you, to know what actually the money is allocated for.
So the, of course, I'm sorry, thank you, Madam Chair. In that chart, that's the second in that chart that you've got in OLIS, GHAP is the acronym for General Housing Account Program. It's doc recording fee. So that's the portion of the document recording fee that goes to multifamily housing. We call it inside my shop GHAP. It helps fill funding gaps, GAP, in project developments. So that's the biggest number there. That's the $12 million. HDGP stands for Housing Development Guarantee Program. It's the old trust fund. Some of you are familiar with the Housing Trust Fund that is administered by my agency. We had a fair amount of that. We also were able to award that. OAHTC stands for Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. That is a state tax credit that goes to banks that they claim as a credit when they reduce the interest rate on a qualifying project, rental project. And the other one is Low Income Weatherization Program. And we were not as successful getting that one out the door. We have some ideas about different ways that we might be able to deploy that.
Okay, that's very useful. And then you'll see page 3, some of the projects around the state. I know there was a concern, particularly from a couple of Deschutes County legislators, about a lot of the document recording fees being generated there and not coming back there, despite tremendous need in addition to the origination of the fees. And I'm pleased to see that there's a couple projects there. It says recommended. Is it now
those were
official?
Approved by the State
they
Housing
were approved.
Council, yes.
Okay, good. Thank you. And then on pages 4, 5, and 6, you can see actually what the projects go toward.
I'd be happy to brief any of you in more detail on all of this. Just wanted to do a quick flyby, and we'll, as I say, we'll true up the accounting of it and
yep.
be able to bring that back if that's helpful.
Okay, great. So any other questions?
Just a comment. I'm encouraged to see you both working together on this topic as I've familiarized myself with the topic. I've been impressed at the contribution the lack of affordable and workforce housing has on poverty and inequality and lackluster job growth. Basically, people get stuck in these areas of that lack opportunity and they can't get to areas where there's robust growth and ability to pursue opportunities. And so housing has deep implications than just the superficial putting the roof over your head. So we've got to solve this problem for a lot of reasons.
Thank you, Representative Buehler. I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, great. So next we have a panel to report on housing needs. So if you can all come up, Commissioner Bill Hall, Jennifer Johnston, and Helen Rodman, you can all come up together. And what we're trying to do in this with this particular panel is kind of reset the stage to remind you about the severity of the housing crisis and why, in this particular short session, we're really focusing on housing. And so there have been housing, I know there have been forums all across the state. There's been CCOs have been doing their community needs assessment. And what I keep hearing from those report backs is that housing has gone from maybe a lower tier or middle tier. It's continually moved up to where it becomes the top four in community needs assessments in many of the different CCO community needs assessments, many different forums that are going around. And I'd love to start with Helen, because you were at the housing forum that we held in Portland last Saturday. And fifth, we invited all of the Portland area, metro area legislators that have some portion of their district that that are inside the metro area. 15 of them came, 12 House members and 3 Senate members. And we basically had a panel of eviction folks, rent increase folks, displacement and trying to hold on to affordable housing folks, homeless folks, and inclusionary zoning and home ownership folks. And so love to start with Helen, and as one area that's kind of galvanized around this issue, and hopefully to get your testimony, which was very compelling, and a little bit of a summary of the other testimonies that you heard while you were there.
Okay. My name is Helen Rodman. I'm a community health nurse with Multnomah County Health Department. I'm work for the Healthy Homes Asthma Program. My clients are all very low-income children diagnosed with asthma. I have been astonished to learn that Portland has a superabundance of unhealthy housing. This is not Portlandia. This is a dark side of Portland that many people do not know about. I've visited dozens of clients living with overwhelming mold, cockroaches, rats, and other asthma triggers, but I'll share the story of just one family. Daniel was a 7-year-old boy who never had any asthma symptoms until several months after moving into a very moldy apartment. It's fairly common for my clients to have to throw away all their bedding and clothes due to intractable mold, but Daniel's family also had to throw away most of their furniture. The apartment was often so cold I could see my own breath. Daniel's mom was afraid to turn the heat up because she was already $200 behind on her power bill and had been warned that the electricity could soon be shut off. As an asthma nurse, I know that it's nearly impossible to control humidity in a cold apartment, and that high humidity is an invitation for the major asthma triggers of mold, dust mites, and cockroaches. But I understand why Daniel's mom didn't turn the heat up. They already struggled enough to pay even for food and rent. After many months of searching, Daniel's family was finally able to move into a mold-free apartment in 2012. Although his parents still struggle mightily to pay for rent and utilities, Daniel's asthma has been well controlled since moving into a healthier apartment. Unfortunately, in the 3 years since, it has become almost impossible to find any housing, healthy or unhealthy, for many of our families. I've worked for low-income families for many years, but I've never seen so many people unable to afford rent. The Healthy Homes program used to focus mainly on teaching about asthma medications and triggers. Now we are increasingly overwhelmed by our clients' needs to find adequate housing. As awful as it is to live in housing which makes children sick, it's worse to have no housing at all. My clients live in terror of being evicted. They know that retaliation for asking for repairs is illegal, but they also know it's almost impossible to prove that retaliation motivated an eviction. Before I came here today, I asked several clients if they would be willing to testify about their struggle to find healthy, affordable housing. Every single person declined. They said they fear that speaking out could lead to their being evicted. Living in a moldy apartment that could cause a dangerous asthma attack is horrible, but it's better than living with their asthmatic child on the street. I'm speaking out now for my clients because they are afraid to speak for themselves. Last Saturday, I shared this story with more than 300 people at the Housing Emergency Forum in Portland. I was one of about 26 people to testify, along with other nurses, community health workers, mothers, grandfathers, students, veterans. I really thought that my story would be one of the most heart-wrenching that day, so I was stunned to hear many other stories that nearly brought me to tears. We heard of mothers who face living in a car with their young children. We heard of domestic violence survivors and their children out on the streets. We heard stories of people who have Section 8 vouchers who cannot find housing in the mandatory 120-day period, so they lose their voucher and they become homeless. We heard about rent increases, a mother of four paying 60% of her income for rent. We heard of a man struggling with mental issues who reacted to being evicted without cause by killing himself. We heard testimony about how a parent's chronic stress over housing can cause their children to regress emotionally and academically. This toxic stress even increases the child's likelihood of developing cancer and other chronic illnesses in later life. We heard of middle-class African-American families being forced out of their historic Northeast Portland neighborhoods by unprecedented rent increases. We heard a lot more that I will not go into right now. There are solutions we can begin to act on right now. In my opinion, these include inclusionary zoning, requiring more notice of rent increases, ending no-cause evictions. If no-cause evictions are allowed to continue, require 90 days advance notice and payment of moving costs, including first and last month's rent. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk about what's going on with some of the people that I work with. And as I said earlier, my clients are afraid to speak out, and I'm speaking for them, hoping that you will be able to take action for them. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do you want to ask questions now?
I want to do the next introduction. But when,
go
after
for it.
Questions.
Would anyone like to ask questions of Helen now? Thank you very much. Please do the intro for the next person.
Thank you, Chair. So in Josephine County, we called together, and we didn't have 300 people come to our housing forum, but we had, if you do the math on the size of your community versus the size, it's actually the same percentage of people. So we had roughly 50 or so people come together from law enforcement, from housing advocates to the CCOs. It was a wonderful conversation. We've invited one of the two CCOs to come and testify today before I introduce her. The other one, we figured Josh Balick from All Care. Thanks for being part of it. It's his birthday, so we figured we wouldn't make him testify today. So make sure you tell him happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
But we wanted to invite Jennifer Johnston up to share about what it was like down there. Again, the issues, we have a lot of similar challenges, but we might have different causes or different ways of going about it when it's in a rural area. And so one of the things that Jennifer compiled for us is in the discussion down there, all these breakout groups came together and basically put their concerns, their thoughts. You know, it's not necessarily this overall flow chart and so forth, but just if you want to hear some of what the rural community is saying, take a look. These are on OLIS, I believe. I haven't checked yet. And we asked her to come share about that and what the CCOs are doing and how all this is working out. So thank you for being here.
Hi. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me to speak today. What I want to share about is a perspective from the health sector, from a CCO. So I'm Jennifer Johnston. I'm the Director of Health Strategy from Primary Health of Josephine County, and we're a small CCO in Southern Oregon that has about 12,000 members, most of which are in Josephine County. So I want to share a little bit about our perspective about the housing forum, and also I want to represent the voice of a rural community and what it's like for us experiencing what we would probably define as a housing crisis. First of all, I will say that I have learned, particularly over the events of the last 2 weeks, that I am not a housing expert. Actually, I realized how very little I know about housing, and actually, if you compare comparatively, I think there's probably, when you look at the rules and laws in the housing sector, they're probably compete with those in the health sector. So it's pretty impressive on the acronyms. So I guess I'll start by kind of framing this, some of the things that I'd like, maybe you could start thinking about. So first of all, one of the issues that we're working on as CCOs is improving some screening rates, particularly colorectal cancer screening. It's one of our incentive measures. So imagine if you were homeless and your primary care provider orders for you to have a preventive colonoscopy. Can you imagine what it might be like to complete the preparation for that procedure? Imagine if you are a type 1 diabetic and you need to manage multiple insulin shots within a day and also coordinate those with meals, but you don't have a way to cook and you don't know really maybe where your next meal is coming from. And imagine if you are hospitalized for an illness or an injury or maybe even a planned hospitalization, and you discharge from the hospital into your car where you're living in the Walmart parking lot, and how difficult it would be to recover from whatever you have been suffering from in that type of an environment. And I can tell you all three of those stories are the things that we deal with every day, and those are all situations we have dealt with in case management over the last month. In addition, over the last few years, through healthcare transformation, we have employed a new workforce of community health workers, and currently we have 72 active clients on their caseloads, and these are our sickest health plan members. So these are probably about the top 1% in terms of costs, many of them are, but they also have really complex medical conditions, social and environmental risk factors, often homelessness. They also often have mental health and substance abuse issues that are not well treated. When I asked our community health workers about homelessness amongst their caseload, I just had them do a quick measurement. 20% of their current caseload is homeless, and this is with the support of community health workers. Over the time that they have been working with these 72 clients, they've supported them through 29 housing transitions, so 29 different housing transitions. And what I hear from them is that when they go out to try to help people with their health conditions, the first thing they need to do is stabilize their social and environmental risk factors like homelessness, like food insecurity, before they ever really can get started on the health issues. And the other thing I hear is that they'll say, we were just really starting to get somewhere, and then they lost their housing. And we had, it's like everything goes on pause, and we have to stop or maybe even go backwards a little bit on any progress we have made towards health and wellness while housing is sorted out. So that just is a little bit of framing where we're coming from as the health sector. And as we've looked more broadly at health, we realize just how very braided health and housing are, particularly in our community. So we decided we needed to, knowing that we were not the housing experts, we put together a housing forum locally. We invited Oregon Housing and Community Services to help us with this, along with our innovator agent from the Oregon Health Authority. And we invited everybody we could think of to come. And we had a lot of wonderful discussion. More people showed up than we expected. We didn't really know what to expect. And we talked and identified lots of issues. And I got to hear from sectors that presented a perspective that I hadn't considered. One example is a representative from District 7 School District shared that in the neighboring county, they had looked at rates, graduation rates for individuals who had left the district for any reason, even once during their educational period between grades 1 through 12. And he shared that the graduation rates went down about 60% if they had even one break. And we know education and housing are very interrelated, and we really as a community would like to improve the rates of kids that graduate from high school. So we also looked at other issues, the same issues that have been brought up. The housing is not affordable. A one-bedroom in our community is $920. Less than 1% of our housing inventory is available. And even more than that, in a small community where services aren't necessarily centralized, we have to get our people to those services often. We have serious issues with drug and alcohol abuse, and very little supported or transitional housing to support a lot of the programs in our community that need help. So those are some of the issues that were pointed out. We talked about some solutions, and what really was most evident came that we need to be working together as a community to coordinate our case management efforts. That's something that we can do right away, and we actually have already started to do that, even since Thursday, set up some meetings to do that. The other thing that we heard is that providing a key is not enough. We need more housing, but we need more housing with supportive services, because these issues that exist will not go away just by giving someone a place to live, that we need to be able to support them so that they are able to maintain the housing placements and eliminate some of those transitions that are really also hurting our community. So I feel positive about the community partners coming together, and that was a first step in working together as a community to make changes. But we have a lot of work to do. So, and thank you.
Jennifer, how far did you come in order to testify today?
From Grants Pass.
And how long does that take to get here?
3.5 hours.
You drive faster than I do.
4 hours.
203 miles.
But thank you very much, because one of the things that we struggle with here is to make sure that we have the rural voice. We have a great rural voice from legislators, and we know what a challenge it is for them to get their constituents here. And it's, I think, critically important that we understand this is not just a Portland metro area issue, that this is, I as chair, you know, I hear about it as a representing my district in Portland, but I also hear about it as a chair from around the state constantly, and I really appreciate you taking a 7-hour round trip in order to help express that voice. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And likewise, you'll have to tell us how long, Bill, it takes you to get here. But I just want to say, since you have passed this out, and I'm assuming it's going on OLIS, you have been very modest in saying who you are. You're going to introduce yourself by a couple different titles, but I just want to say, out of looking you up, since I only met you a few days ago, I want to read off a couple of the other things that you've done, because I think it really is illustrative of how much housing is connected to the other issues. So you co-chair the Lynn Benton Lincoln Early Learning Hub, which is something that the legislature has put enormous amount of time to making sure that kids get off to the right start. The Community Services Consortium, which is the regional community action agency, Cascades West Council of Governments, Local Public Safety Coordinating Committee, Neighborhood Partnerships, statewide organization addressing poverty, homelessness, and housing issues, the Lincoln County Land Trust Board, Partnership Against Drug and Alcohol Abuse, Samaritan House Family Homeless Shelter, North Coast Leadership Council for Oregon Community Foundation. Those are current. There's a long list of previous, if you want to look them up under the Lincoln County website, including co-chairing the Oregon Ending Homelessness Advisory Council, et cetera. It goes on and on. Workforce Investment Board, recovery housing, Rotary Club, etc. I do want to point out, in 2008, your local, state, and national leadership on homelessness issues was honored with the Home for Every American Award presented by the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness at a conference in Washington, D.C., and it goes on and on. So I just want to say that you present yourself as a county commissioner, which is critically important, but you come with enormous background. And so I'm hoping that you can help us not only represent the rural perspective, because it's really important for us to hear that, but also what kind of trends you've seen over time in this issue.
Well, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, thank you. Thank you for that very generous introduction. One thing that I guess I didn't mention on my website, well, of course, I am the chair of the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners.
And do say your name for the record, please.
Yes, for the record, Bill Hall of New Newport, Chair of the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners and Vice President of the Association of Oregon Counties. And one thing I somehow left off of that list was serving a couple of years ago with Representative Parrish and many other folks on the ABC work group. So, yes, I have invested a lot of time and a lot of effort on this issue. This is my 12th year in office, and I'm going to try to give you a little bit of flavor of why I think this is so important. One challenge that the coast, the Columbia River Gorge, I think Central Oregon, other popular tourist destinations face is that a large portion of our homes are not full-time residences. The best estimate we have in Lincoln County is about one quarter of all housing stock is not full-time residences. Some of these are vacation homes. A lot of them are full-time vacation rentals, and that number is growing. For a long time, Newport's vacancy rate has hovered at a very tight 2%, but it's now less than 1%, and I've been asking people why that is, and what I'm told is some folks previously who were renting on a month-to-month basis have converted to nightly rentals through Airbnb. You know, the difference between incomes and the price of housing is another huge driver of housing scarcity. Our median wages are below valley levels, but our housing is often just as expensive, if not more so. From 1990 to 2010, the average cost of housing in Lincoln County grew exactly twice as fast as average wages. One of the big drivers of development costs on the coast is a scarcity of buildable land. We've got little available residential property, and anything that's waterfront or view property is out of the range of affordability. Most development that does take place is for the upper end market. According to the Census Bureau, from 2010 to 2014, only 178 affordable units were built in Lincoln County. A study that the City of Newport commissioned in 2012 found that community alone has a deficit of more than 800 housing units. And that was even before the exciting plans were finalized for Oregon State University to increase its Newport presence by more than 500 students, faculty, and support staff. So what happens when people can't afford to live in places like Lincoln County? I'm hearing again and again, I mean, it was even a problem 12 years ago when I was first running for county commissioner, and the drumbeat on this has just increased steadily. Businesses cannot recruit and retain qualified workers. And this isn't just for entry-level jobs. A former director of the hospital in Lincoln City told me he couldn't believe that he had nurses regularly commuting from McMinnville. Teachers have turned down contract offers with our school district because of not being able to find decent, affordable places to live. In the county, we have had trouble even recruiting all the way up to department director level positions because of housing prices. Our roads are more congested because people have long commutes. Our community diversity suffers. Many of us in local government are worried about timely emergency response in a crisis. Think about what's going to happen if medical personnel, first responders, public works employees can't get to their work sites. You know, as we've already talked about, the state has made big investments in creating CCOs and early learning hubs. We have already heard really powerful testimony about the linkage between stable, healthy homes and good health outcomes. Similar data is available for good educational outcomes as well. You know, I tell people that this is an overnight crisis that has been decades in the making. You know, it's been the result of economic forces, policy choices made at the federal, state, and local levels. I really appreciate all of your service and your interest in helping to forge a path out of this crisis. You know, I understand we're at more of a high level today, but I want to emphasize my belief that it's going to take a whole host of tools in the toolbox to get us there. It's going to take flexible dollars, tax incentives, more flexibility in planning and zoning, but I really believe that Oregon is up to the task. Thank you.
Thank you. And Commissioner Hall, how long did it take you to drive here from Lincoln City?
Well, it depends on traffic, but usually if I'm pushing it, 90 minutes, and it can take as long as 2 hours,
okay,
depending on how
so
busy.
So 3 to 4 hours round trip.
Yes.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks for the opportunity.
I do want to point out there are many materials on OLIS at the community forum that Helen talked about. The card stocks were, because we had 26 people speaking in 2 hours, we had card stock that was given up that people could put on the wall, and those were scanned in. We had tremendous community groups that put that on, the Affordable Housing Alliance of Oregon, the Oregon Opportunities Network, Proud Ground, Welcome Home Coalition, Community Alliance of Tenants really took the lead on this. So I want to give them credit, but a lot of the materials that they helped scan are on OLIS, as well as the testimony of Chloe, who is a business person with a disabled son. Her testimony is on there. Margot Black, who didn't have the opportunity to testify but did put it in writing, is on there. Just tremendous. And thank you to those of you from the metro area that were able to come. So I want to make sure that you see that. And I think the thing that has really come through that I just want to make sure before we start talking about committee bills and personal bills is the incredible prevalence across the state on this. And I think that a lot of people traditionally, at least I'll speak for myself, have thought of housing crisis more in terms of the homeless population, because that is what you see. So when you think housing crisis, you might think homeless. And I think what's really clear is that so many more people are rent burdened. And so we don't always see that. But those are people who maybe are facing asthma and mold and missing schools and days in school because they're scared of eviction because there's nowhere to go out there. And so we don't see those people necessarily. School teachers see it, and we're hearing about kids who are priced out or evicted and then having to go to another school district, and yet we're trying to make our 40-40-20 goals. And we put $7.55 billion into education. We put billions of dollars into human services. We put billions of dollars into healthcare, and yet we are not putting anywhere near equivalent amount of money into making sure that we have housing available. So that's just a sea change that I think we need, since the feds have been cutting over the decades, that we really need to address, that is a very real trend. And we're seeing the combination of that with the combination of the recession exacerbating a lot of those factors, combination of Airbnb and long-term rentals going into short-term rentals may play a small role, but it's a role, and lack of tools. We all might argue about what those tools are, but clearly Oregon has tied its hands in terms of not having the real estate transfer tax, so we don't have that source of money. We're one of the few two states without inclusionary zoning. We have just tied our hands in a variety of ways. So that's kind of my launching ground for turning our attention now to committee bills. So we had three committee bills drafted. That is all we are allowed to do. All three of them had to do with housing. Thank you for your, unless anyone has any questions for them. Did you want to say something?
I'd just like to make a comment and like to thank Commissioner Hall. I'm a partner in a business in your county, and fortunately a growing successful business.
Great.
And the biggest deterrent to the business growing even more is we cannot find employees.
That doesn't surprise me.
Over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And these are good paying jobs. And
yeah.
It's been that way for at least 3 or 4 years and getting worse nearly every month.
It's
Thank
a story
you.
I hear again and again.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for letting us know what it's like in your communities. Okay. Quick. Yep. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to make a quick statement about OLIS. If you've been looking ahead at what's to come on the bills that were listed, there was a mix-up in numbers on the LC that was attributed to me. So please don't come talk to me about LC 164. I know nothing about it. It wasn't mine. We just got it swapped out and got the right one in there. So
146.
If you've been reading,
yours
146 is mine.
Right.
164, I don't know anything about. So
right.
If you were looking ahead, that's now been corrected, so it's reposted there.
Okay, great. All right, thank you.
Thanks.
So you can go, and I'll just carry on about the committee bills. So we had the LIFT bill, which is now going to be starting the Senate. The second bill that you may have heard me talking about is actually no longer a committee bill. It's been switched. It's now a personal bill. It is the Housing Relief Act, so I'm going to talk about that later. And my personal bill has now instead become a committee bill. We made a switch at the last minute, and I want to just say a couple things about that. The LC number is... LC-280 should be on OLIS now, since you will be voting on whether to introduce this. And I'm not going to go into any details, and this is not the forum to have a big policy debate. It's just to get things on the radar. But one of the things that we want to do is make sure that we have more housing stock. We know that there's a big crunch out there, and we need to start building more, building or converting more housing stock. So there are two pieces to this committee bill. One of them is to increase the document recording fee. Currently, it's $20 to go to affordable housing, and that's for construction of new multi-family housing, as well as single-family housing, as well as emergency housing assistance. It used to be $15, and a couple of years ago, we added $5 so that we could designate 25% of that to veterans. Am I characterizing it correctly? So it's now $20, and the proposal here would be to increase it to $10. So that's one part of it, and the idea is to continue putting money into housing and community services where it can be combined with other sources of funding. This would bring about $5 million a year, $10 million a biennium to add to the housing stock. So I think that the state should be doing way more than that, but it's a start. We don't have many places to turn for funds. The second part of the bill is something that I'm hoping Representative Parrish will mention, because it came out of the ABC workforce, and it was brought to us by the Affordable Housing Alliance, who had been a part of that workforce that Representative Parrish and Representative Reardon were on, and it's the capital gains tax exemption.
So, and I haven't seen it as it's drafted in the bill, but one of the things that we, I'll step back. When we met, and there's, again, thanks to all the people in the room who did the work, because it's totally yeoman's work, but when we met, we came up with 40-some items. I think some of you have heard me say this before, but just a refresher, that ran the spectrum from totally consensus to totally contentious, and then some in between. And one of the ones that did come forward that really didn't give anybody heartburn was about incentivizing through a capital gains reduction for affordable housing, and really with the thought that if the state is going to take an interest and ask people to sort of give up some income from selling a property or building a property, or the choice, you know, if we're going to say we want you to create X amount of affordable housing as a requirement to get permits, then the trade should be that we should support that effort. And if we're going to use dollars, we should use them to help offset that. And so from that is this notion that there would be some kind of capital gain reduction from the sale of property or, you know, a finished product, if it is specifically being used for affordable housing, that collectively we should all be interested in that as a society. So that's where that came from. I haven't seen the final details that are being brought forward in the bill, but I'm hugely supportive of that effort.
Yeah, so it would be eligible for housing authorities or nonprofit community development corporations, and basically it's taking the market rate housing that we have out there and selling it with exemption from capital gains to housing authorities or these nonprofit CDCs to manage affordable housing. So it's another tool that we can give them so that they can use that as leverage as they are going through a bargaining process. Maybe someone is willing to sell at a little bit less because they won't have to pay the capital gains. So those are the two ideas. They may or may not be referred here, so I wanted to make sure you had a chance to hear it, because there's several different bills going forward trying to address housing. It may end up getting referred directly to revenue, because that's the committee that's going to have to see it. So that's one committee bill, and we will be voting at the end of this on whether to introduce that as a committee bill. And the second one is general assistance. So John Mullen, please. And this is for, what's the name of the number? Forget. So LC-96 on OLIS. This is a bill we have seen before.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I want to begin with an apology. The testimony I submitted on OLIS has January 14th, 2015. I do actually know that this is the year 2016, but I would also point out that coming up is February 2nd, Groundhog's Day. And for those of you who've seen this movie, Groundhog's Day, it feels like it for me. I've been at this since funding for general assistance went away back in 2005. Well, I will be very brief in my testimony today because, as the chair said, this is really about a matter about whether this will be adopted as a committee bill. General assistance, I don't need to go into a whole lot of background and detail because you all have had information and we had a thorough briefing about this last session. We had the results of the study about general assistance. But I just want to point out a couple of things, and then I want to end with some thanks and be happy to answer any questions. As I mentioned, we've been without general assistance funding now for over 10 years. And this particular draft that's in front of you follows on the discussion that we had during the last session, which this committee approved and sent on to Ways and Means and was not funded. There are two elements of it that are different that I want to point out. We really heard members of the committee having concern about an evaluation, and we dropped the evaluation out. It doesn't make sense to call this a pilot program anymore because we're not looking at an evaluation of a program. We're really simply knowing, as advocates and the work that we've done over the years, that this is a program that really works. As you know from last session, one of the features that is different, general assistance used to be, in addition to the assistance that was provided in helping people qualify for federal disability benefits, there was a cash grant of $314. And we decided that it made more sense when we were doing the general assistance study to really look at a housing first model. And so what we have in front of you today is a bill that would take people who are on the presumptive Medicaid caseload, and I can explain more in detail if you'd like to understand that a little bit better.
Maybe not today.
Pardon me?
Not today.
Not today.
It's complicated.
Right. And it is a complicated
Thank
situation.
You.
But in fact, we know that on that particular caseload, there are a number of people who, of course, would have qualified for general assistance if we had it. We also know that among that population, there are quite a number of people that are homeless. And so we decided to target this bill towards the people who are the neediest. We often call this population the poorest of the poor. And those people that are homeless on top of this is really the population that we are really seeking to serve. So basically, the information is there. I just want to end with some thanks because I think that I know you have a very full agenda today. I want to thank the General Assistance Steering Committee. A number of people are here in the room. I want to thank actually the Oregon Law Center. I should start with them. When I went to work with the Oregon Law Center, they were already very supportive of general assistance and have allowed me to have an opportunity to be before this committee on many occasions. I want to thank all of you and your predecessors. We have, each time there's been a bill, there's been good discussion, and the bill has been sent on to Ways and Means where it's languished and hasn't passed in the past, and I'm really hoping that 2016 is the year. I also want to thank the Department of Human Services. They've been really good about providing information, helping us all the way along the line. And I want to thank you, Madam Chair, especially, and also Speaker Tina Kotek, who has spoken out about the need for general assistance in the context of making progress on housing. So with that, I would simply stop and see if there is any questions. We are really hoping that, again, that the committee will adopt this as a committee bill, and we look forward to talking with you more in detail about this during the session. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. So, John, the bill last session, there was a $1 million price tag that you had, you know, come up with that went for the 200 individual cap. The ask was $1 million. And it had a very expensive study, and that was the big concern for those who said no, at least what we heard voiced. The bill I'm looking at now still has the 200 people, but doesn't have a dollar amount listed there. Why is that, and what do you forecast it being different than what
right.
it was?
Madam Chair, Representative Stark, very good question. Actually, the general fund price tag for the bill last session was $2.9 million general fund. For the first biennium. It's complicated because paradoxically the bill costs less in the next biennium because right. we get recoveries that come in, but it's an excellent question. Preliminary information from the Department of Human Services said that this biennium, if we were to enact it, have a July 1st startup date, there'd be a $1.7 million price tag for general fund price tag. And then paradoxically, in the next biennium, we get recoveries of about $2.25 million. And so really the net over a three-year period is about $1.64 million.
So just to reiterate with the general assistance program, it's people who are applying for SSI, SSDI, disability benefits. And we've had people come and speak about losing a job after a car accident or a tractor accident, and then they can't pay their rent because they lost their job, and then eventually they end up out on the streets. There's a spiral that happens. And so this fronts the money to them that they would be paid for by the federal government, but it often takes 2 years to work its way through the bureaucracy. And the people that get into the program are the ones that are highly likely to have their case heard. They're ones that DHS believes do deserve disability payments. And so I think in the past, the return rate was something like 85%. So not everyone necessarily will get their case approved. That doesn't mean that 15% didn't help people, actually. But a lot of the money comes back, and that's the out-of-cost. It's not the case management for DHS, but it's the out-of-pocket that we give people to subsidize them for housing or other kinds of things that they need. Is that right?
Madam Chair, that's right, and thank you for that explanation. I know that we've gone over this in some detail during the last session, but I think it's a very helpful reminder. For anybody that's interested, I also put some of the history there as appended to my testimony so that you can take a look at it in detail. And we, of course, would be happy to answer any questions before the February session and to talk further again when session comes up.
So. I hope that this committee will. We're going to start a work session soon, even though we have it at the end of the agenda. I think it makes sense to do it now when we just heard the two committee bills. But if you do have concerns or questions, this is one of those that I'm hoping we can send off to the next Ways and Means subcommittee so they can consider it. I think that in light of how urgent this issue has become, the program's always made sense to me, but I think it's moved up in the list of priorities given how how much homelessness is such a huge issue for people. It's just we're trying to get at it every different angle we can. So thank you for keeping the flame, the torch going, so we can try to catch up with you.
Thank you.
Okay. If there are no more questions, I'm going to close the informational hearing and open a work session for the purpose of introducing our two committee bills. And I want to remind you that by voting for this does not mean that you necessarily support the committee bills. It means that you're accepting that the committee will entertain these. Okay.
Chair Kinnegar, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 96, dated January 13th, 2016, and LC 280, dated January 14th, 2016.
Vice Chair Stark moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 96, dated January 13, 2016, LC 280, dated January 14, 2016. Is there any discussion? Okay. Any objection? All right. If none, the measures are introduced as committee bills. Thank you. I want to reopen the session now, close the work session, and open it to hear members' personal housing bills. The people, who do we have here? We have Representative Stark, Representative Evans, and myself, all from this committee, Representative Gorsuch and Representative Witt. Are Representative Gorsuch or Witt here yet?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Witt is currently chairing the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee. I believe he'll be joining us shortly.
Okay, great. And if you want to text. We don't have okay, well, we will call Representative Gorsuch, but Representative Stark, would you like to start?
Sure.
And you are welcome to do it here or right up here.
Do you have a preference?
No, I don't.
Okay. Thank you. So one of the things that I've learned as I've gone to these housing forums and gone on housing tours is really that the state is incredibly diverse, if we didn't already know that. And so trying to figure out what solutions work in different areas, a one-size-fits-all isn't really, in my opinion, probably won't work, because Portland is different than Southern Oregon. Bend is different. All these areas are different. And so really I wanted to put forward a very simple bill. It's LC 146 is what it is right now. And one of the issues in rural Oregon that we just heard a little while ago is that people want to build, but there is a lack of buildable land. And so we've gone through this debate over the years, and we've heard people talk about this. And so really, I'm proposing that we take a baby step into exploring this. And the idea is two pilot projects, one in a smaller city, and from Southern Oregon, I can say a smaller city is 30,000 or so, and one in a larger city, excluding Metro, but over 30,000. And we're proposing that specifically for mixed housing, so affordable and general housing, that somebody could come forward and expand the UGB, and there's criteria, you can read about the criteria, specifically for these types of developments. And, you know, would not be more than 50 acres. And we're writing it fairly, given LCDC a lot of freedom with how they define some of the things. And the reason for that, because whether it's manufacturing or apartments and so forth, is that what we want to encourage is local communities to say, we believe that this is an issue and a solution in our community. And then to come forward and say, LCDC, would this fit into your criteria of affordable housing with some of the things that you've put forward in the guidance that you put forward on this? And then be able to talk it out. So someone might come forward and say, hey, we want mixed housing of affordable housing for purchase because it's difficult for middle income or low income to buy a house right now. Or somebody might come forward and a builder might say, hey, I'm really excited about building a multifamily complex, you know, apartments and so forth, and I'm willing to do some of them as affordable. Can we do that? And that might be the solution. So the idea is really just to encourage the communities to start thinking about your specific area. If there's a lack of buildable land, would this make a difference? Come up with a proposal and bring it forward for the pilot. So fairly small, simple. See if I'm missing any of my smaller points. I think that's my main points. It is somewhat... This concept has been visited in the past a couple times, and so it's reworking a couple bills that have gotten traction in the past and trying to, again, to simplify that and remove some of the things in there. There's some things that we specifically didn't address, such as the definition of affordable housing, knowing that there are other bills that might be addressing that and giving the location and the scenario what people feel like is affordable or... Again, the issue in that specific area might be different from somewhere else. So rather than a one-size-fits-all, let's open it up, try it out, and see what happens.
Okay, thank you. I think we'll probably hold off on questions. The purpose of this is so you can air what's out there, and you can ask questions if anyone has feelings, positive, negative, about any of our bills. And this is an opportunity in the next couple weeks because we're going to have to hit the ground running. So it's mostly just to air it. I do see Representative Witt here, and I know you have a personal bill on housing. Would you like to present that to us?
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Chair and members of the committee, Brad Witt, State Representative for House District 31, appearing before you this afternoon to introduce LC 92. This is a legislative concept that would enable Oregon's Habitat for Humanity to make affordable mortgage loans to low-income Oregonians. LC 92 creates a framework that makes this possible. It creates an affordable housing mortgage fund, the affordable housing mortgage fund, which would be housed in the Treasury Department, and appropriates money on a continuing basis to the Housing and Community Services Department. So fund at Treasury and then the Housing Department. The Housing Department then, well, the fund would consist of seed money from the state of Oregon. And I want to emphasize that I'm not here asking you for money today. That's not part of this legislative concept. And I am unaware of any other legislative concept to do that. That's anticipated down the road, likely 17 and or beyond. And the money, and as well as money raised by Habitat for Humanity and its supporters. So that fund would be open for contributions both from public and private entities. The fund then would make interest-free loans to Habitat for Humanity of Oregon. And it would make this on a revolving mortgage loan basis, again, to low-income Oregonians. What constitutes low-income? The average customer for Habitat is about $22,000 per year income level. And it would do this via the local Habitat for Humanity organizations, the local organization. I want to stress a couple of things. Number one, the very, very, very great need for low-income housing in the state of Oregon. This is a vehicle not just to assist people with housing. This program is a vehicle to provide home ownership for low-income Oregonians. This would make this program unique. We do not have that that capability at this point. Currently, Habitat is meeting about 15% of the demand for home ownership among low-income Oregonians that it receives. How is defined by 15% of those people who actually complete an application to enter into Habitat's home process, home ownership process. The second thing I want to emphasize is Habitat's absolutely great track record. They built 1,300 homes, built and sold in Oregon over the past 35 years, not coming close to meeting the demand. Therefore, this program to help implement that, and a 98% repayment of those mortgage loans that they've let. Absolutely incredible record. LC92 is modeled after programs in 8 other states around the country. It will provide for full annual reporting, compliance with underwriting for mortgage loans, as well as loan servicing standards, and last but not least, of course, because it will be through the Department of Treasury or the Treasury Department, subject to a full complement of auditing procedures as well. Tremendous need. Great entity, great organization that will be handling this, and I would urge your support for this concept. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, again, no questions now, but it's on your radar. Contact Representative Witt if you are interested. Look up the bill on OLIS, and thank you for bringing this idea forward.
Madam Chair, thank you so much for this opportunity. Truly appreciate it.
Okay, great. All right, Representative Evans, you should be next.
Okay.
And you are welcome to do it from there or?
Other from here.
Okay.
All right. LC237. For those keeping track of such things. The bill, very simple, provides certainty to nonprofit providers of low-income housing that have relied upon property tax exemptions granted under ORS 307.130. Bottom line is, if we're talking about expanding more opportunities for low-income housing, perhaps the first thing to do is make sure we don't lose any of the existing. In a current court case, has been going on for some time, brought legislation in 2012, 2014. This simply gets rid of the sunset and makes sure that for those areas that are actually providing low-income housing through nonprofits, that they're not taxed. The courts will probably clarify it, but just in case, it makes sure that it's a done deal. There's frustration, understandably so, throughout the state at the local level. So many counties have been very creative in trying to find ways to tax entities, and some nonprofits are not like all nonprofits. Mm-hmm. But in this particular case, the language is tightly written to make sure that the space, the land, the building is being used for the purpose it should be. And it basically has no impact in terms of cost because it's already the law. We're simply getting, right now it would go through 2018, this simply gets rid of the sunset. Simple, straightforward, I hope.
Great. And I just want to say, if anyone hears LCs that they're particularly interested in signing onto, you can always do that after the session starts and the bill's already dropped. But if you want to do it before the bill is dropped, go see the author and see if you can add your name on as a sponsor. Okay, anyone else besides me on this that's here? Nope, I don't think so. So the bill that I have is what is being called the Omnibus Bill because there are several different pieces in it. We also call it the Housing Relief Act of 2016 because some of the ideas from it arose actually after Portland and Eugene declared an emergency. And part of what Portland did to respond to that was to extend the notification for no-cause evictions that happen after the first year of tenancy. And the which is currently 60 days, they extended it to 90 days. And the rent increase also, they increased that from 30 days to 90 days. And Representative Gorsuch's bill basically was created a long time ago, and it very much mirrors the Portland bill. The bill that I'm doing, I want to just say first, I think we all know that we need to get more housing stock, and so some of the bills we've mentioned so far are trying to do that. There's also an attempt to deal with some of the emergencies by making some requests for the emergency housing account, which helps people with rental subsidies and things like that. We're going to be asking for $8 million in one-time, not roll-up funding, and then the Shelter Housing Assistance Program, SHAP, $2 million for that. So we're going to try to help people who are in incredible duress right now, but there are several other things that can bring relief to people immediately that are in my housing relief bill. One of that is around the tenant protection. So the two pieces that are in Gorsuch's bill, the 90-day notification for no-cause evictions after the first year, as well as the 90-day notification for rent. In addition to that, we used to have in the law a retaliation statute that said landlords may not evict people with no cause within 6 months of a tenant complaining about a broken dishwasher or mold or something that is a legitimate complaint. And that was used to be in the law, and we want to restore it. It simply puts the onus, instead of the tenant to prove it, it's more the onus on the landlord to prove that they didn't retaliate. So it strengthens our retaliation statute, because many, many people, as you heard in testimony before, when they are terrified of being evicted because there's nowhere else to go, they are really scared of saying anything, and they end up with very severe health concerns. So that's another piece. And then another piece would be 1 month rent, again, after the first year of tenancy. If there's a no-cause eviction, then it's very hard for people to relocate because they have to pay their last month and their deposit. It's 2 months. Frankly, a lot of the advocates wanted 2 months, and I think 2 months is very fair. But in light of this being a short session, we wanted to bring some relief. And what is in my proposal, for starters, is 1 month to help toward relocation. And then lastly, the last piece of this tenant protection, so that's 4 out of 5, the last piece is no rent increase for the first year. What we're hearing that people are moving into their rentals, and 3 months later they get a rent increase of maybe $100. And they've worked really hard to figure out, when they're looking for a place, and it's very expensive to relocate, they're looking for a place, they figure out how much their income is, and they figure out how much they can spend, and then all of a sudden, within a few months, they have an increase in bill. So that's the 5 pieces to the tenant protection. And I also just want to say that there are many fabulous landlords out there. I have a lot of landlords who are friends of mine, who I've talked to, who, when I say, does this sound reasonable, they're like, yeah, I would never move someone in and then immediately go 3 months later and raise the rent. So I have, we did have a work group. There were different feelings on the work group. Speaker Kotek and I had a work group with landlords and builders and realtors, affordable housing advocates, tenants. And in a short amount of time, we came from here to here. I am putting my best foot forward in terms of what I think is very, very modest. It's not anywhere near what tenants think they need to have any kind of stability from the kinds of things that you heard earlier, but I think it's a step in the right direction. I think it can really help people's lives. So that is the tenant protection piece. The second piece is the inclusionary zoning, both for home ownership and rentals, and it basically completely echoes what Senator Denbrough has introduced as a workforce committee bill on his side. So you can see his alone. It's 281, or you can read it in the middle of my personal bill. And the reason that we're putting it here as well, even though we passed it last time, is because we only passed the home ownership side. We did not pass the rental side. And I want to make sure that we have the opportunity to have a conversation about it as well. May stay in, may not, depending on what's happening with the Senate, but I think that we should at least be able to have the conversation about it. The third piece, so I thought of this as kind of three buckets. One is, what should we do statewide? That's the tenant protection. What should we do to lift preemptions for cities so they have more tools? That's the inclusionary zoning, or inclusive housing, I call it. And the third is, what should we do for cities when they're in an emergency? So in that bucket, we have allowing cities who declare an emergency to relax or not have to follow state building and zoning codes with regard to where they put shelters. So we hopefully are going to get more specifics about that before we actually talk about it. But right now, it's kind of just a general statement, and the League of Cities and others are going to get back to me on that. So those are the three pieces of that particular bill, and I would be happy to talk to anyone between now and when we start and after we start on February 1st. And if anyone would like to sign on, I'd be delighted to have you. I think that's it for personal bills. The one other piece besides the $10 million for EHA and SHAP that I want to mention is that there's a request from the Affordable Housing Advocates for $17.5 million to preserve affordable housing. Many of these are the buildings that had HUD contracts for 30 years that helped subsidize rents, and after 30 years, those go back to market rate. And this would allow us to allow people to stay in those units. We have a lot of seniors who have been in these communities for a long time and then can't pay the market rate rent when it goes up. So $17.5 million is a tall order. It comes out of lottery-backed bonds. But we're going to – I will push as hard as I can, because I think that's something that we really recognize. When people are already in a community, it's really important to both keep that stock and not displace people. So any efforts that any of you would like to make in talking to our co-chairs, we have a list of units that look over the next 5 years like they're going to come up, and that amounts to about $55 million. So we need to make really big headway on that. Okay. Well, do we need to gavel out that part? Okay. So we are now going to move toward an informational hearing on EITC, increase in utilization. So we're moving out of the housing realm and into the human services part of our discussion. And Representative Jeff Riordan, did you want to say something?
Can I just make a comment?
Sure. Make a comment while you're
just
settling
to close
in.
The housing. I think a lot of ideas here. I think people have the best of intentions to solve this problem. But I think we're headed down a very dangerous road if we continue to stimulate the demand for housing in the state of Oregon without increasing the supply of land. This is pretty basic economic fundamentals. If you cap the supply of something and you whip demand, price is going to continue to increase. That happens in almost any market. And most of the ideas I've heard here today just stimulate demand without doing anything to increase the supply of land, and will just make the problem worse.
So I want to say on that, we're going to have good, healthy debate about it, but one of the things that Representative Buehler and I are doing are trying to understand each other's different contexts. And so I'll just share with the group that I am visiting Bend at the invitation of Representative Buehler next Friday, the 22nd, and he's set up a tour of a lot of different groups with housing needs, and then he will be coming to the Portland metro area on January 29th to see some of our needs. So I appreciate the ongoing dialogue.
And this is just not my opinion, but Jason Furman, the chair of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, made a major speech just 2 months ago calling out that the problem with the lack of affordable housing in the United States is mostly driven because of local land use regulations and a lack of supply. There is a vast abundance of really high-quality economic literature, not from right-wing think tanks, but from Harvard University, that show a preponderance of evidence this is the problem. The problem in most of the West Coast states, the problem in the Northeast and in South Florida. And if you doubt my opinion, look it up for yourself. Really investigate this problem. Really look at the information out there, because it is overwhelming that the root cause, and I think it's important to diagnose the root cause of the problem, is a lack of buildable, affordable land in this state and several others.
So lots of root causes out there. I mean, I will say that another root cause that I've been tracking a lot of information on is during the foreclosure crisis, a lot of hedge funds and portfolio managers were buying up some of the foreclosed properties, which took them out of first-time home ownership, turned them into rentals. And so there are so many different causes, from the lack of investment from the feds to what has happened in our recession, where we stopped building anything, even when there was land, stopped building supply because they didn't have access to capital. People who used to rent, you know, didn't have a job anymore, moved in with their parents. I mean, there are just multiple reasons, and we are going to try in a very short amount of time to have healthy debates about all the different root causes and see what we can do in a short session to really flip the switch on a lot of these things. Some of these are short-term solutions, some are long-term solutions, and we're going to try to look at as many as we can. Okay, so turning to the Human Services side, Representative Reardon.
Thank you. For the record, I am Jeff Reardon, State Representative, District 48. And I think I can talk to you something today. I'm really optimistic it'll have minimal debate, but maybe I'm being too optimistic. In 2013, when I joined the legislature, we had discussions about earned income tax credit, and you know, everything was new back then, so nobody really explained what it was. So I'm going to take a few minutes today to talk a little bit about what is the earned income tax credit and why you would want to support it for a couple of different reasons. So it started actually back in 1975. All right. Started in 1975, I used to be a teacher. Program to help low-income moms and other families go to work and to get on the path to self-sufficiency, something that we all aspire to. That is the Earned Income Tax Credit Program. And it started actually as an economic growth policy 40 years ago. It's paid as a tax refund check, so it can provide a little extra for that deferred car repair, for education, for child care. It is received once a year, so it's rarely used for daily needs. That's a proven policy that can improve life for working lower-income Americans. It encourages and rewards work. It incents people to leave public assistance and remain employed. And it encourages people to increase their work hours to take advantage of the Earned Income Tax Credit. It's actually one federal program that's achieved proven results since 1975. Mothers who receive the Earned Income Tax Credit are less likely than other low-income mothers to smoke before and after pregnancy, and more likely to eat healthy diets, deliver babies at healthy birth weights. Children in these families actually score better on math and reading tests than low-income children who do not receive the Earned Income Tax Credit. And children from these families, on average, go on to earn 17% more when they reach adulthood than do children from low-income families who don't receive Earned Income Tax Credit. And actually, they boost their Social Security retirement because they're earning more over the years. So let's get back to Oregon. We've sweetened the federal EITC slightly starting in 1997. Oregonians who qualify now get an additional 8% of their federal rate. But the challenge for Oregon remains huge. Oregon has more citizens living in poverty than during the height of the 2008-2009 recession, 16.7%. One in five children live in poverty, over 21%. And obviously our work is not done. Increasing the Earned Income Tax Credit has proven to reduce poverty for targeted groups. Rigorous studies indicate a $1,000 increase leads to a 7.3% increase in employment, fewer children having to receive public health insurance coverage, and even larger reductions in the obesity rate in rural communities. And you think about what happens. Think about if you get a tax refund of $500 to $1,000. That's pretty cool, right? You might take a trip to Bend or something for the weekend, maybe the coast. If you are that low-income family, you get that same kind of a boost once a year. You might do something really wild, like get the car fixed, maybe get some dental work done that hadn't been done or something. There's just so many needs at that level. So it's something that makes a huge impact, and that fact that it comes once a year is almost like a forced savings, so they'll have a little extra when they need it. Where does that money go to? You think these families are not investing it in Wall Street? I can trust me. They're spending it in their local communities, and we can actually get printouts showing district by district how much money flows back into communities, and so that's where the economic development part fits in. So I ask you to consider, you know, of all the billions that this state spends in tax credits, are there any better that serve working families or better at pumping money into local economies? And I'm sure you'll agree that the answer is resounding no. No other tax credit provides more immediate relief to struggling families, and none get more money into local communities as effectively. I can tell you that the speaker is on in support of this move, and I'm expecting to get funding. I didn't know how far we'd get this session. I still don't know. I mean, we haven't started yet, but much more optimistic than I was, say, a couple of days ago. So I hope you're on board. I hope if you have any questions, you'll listen to the wisdom of your chair and or come by and we can chat about a little bit more. Also, one last closing remark. The Oregon Business Council is very much behind this. So it's a business community partnering with public folks that are saying this is a great idea. When you couple this, allowing people that work hard to keep a little bit more of their money, and maybe on the other hand, if we get to that point, they also get a little raise at the same time. That combination of those things is what is a very powerful tool, much more than just doing one policy or the other. So with that, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to try to respond. If not, I'd be happy to come back next session, and otherwise I need to get back next door.
So what's the LC number for your bill, which is to increase the rate, the ITC?
That number has bounced around. It's a little bit. Sorry. I got excited.
That's all right.
I didn't bring the bill with me, but it's looking at – the nice thing is you can target it to low-income families, and perhaps if we have a limited amount of money, then you can target it at – families that have, say, a child below 1 year or 2 years, and that sort of controls how much money is spent on that tax credit. So I have, I think it's, I'm saying off the top of my head, I think it's 16%, raise it to 16% for families with kids under 2 years old. So it would help those. I mean, you think about those are the families that maybe mom can't work right after she's had that baby. So they could use that extra income at that time especially.
So right now it's 8% of the federal EITC, and the proposal is for families with kids up to 2 years old, we would increase that to 16%. And as I read your LC, for families with kids between 3 and 5, it's to increase it up to 14%. And Representative Buehler and I worked on this last year with a work group. And it was one of the things that there was wide agreement on, and had we gone that direction at the time, we would have been the first state to increase the EITC for families with young children, recognizing how, you know, we want to encourage the bonding with young kids, and in addition to what we provide in tax credits for child care, we really wanted to provide a tax credit for people whose income might drop because they're spending time with their kids. That did not go through because it wasn't one of the original packets of all the parts of all the tax credits that were up for renewal, but it was an idea that had a lot of attraction and we thought was really important to bring back in this session. So if you want to sign on to that, we are co-chiefing it together, but he's the lead on that, and then I'm the lead on the second one, which he's also co-chiefing, which is to increase our utilization rate, and I think the rest of our panel is going to be focused a little bit more on that. But encourage anyone who's interested to sign on to those bills. So thank you, Representative.
All right,
Brandon.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So the next panel that we have is John DePonia, Chuck Sheketoff, and Rob Justice. Would you like to start?
Set.
Sounds good.
For the record, I'm John Taponia, president of Echo Northwest, a regional economic consulting firm, and I do consulting with the Oregon Business Plans Poverty Task Force that Representative Reardon made reference to. First of all, I will say that of all the issues that this body deals with, I think the earned income tax credit falls in the top. In the top three of any committee across the state's work. Absolutely critical piece of labor market innovation that at the national level has bipartisan support. I will just comment on the couple of pieces, the two different initiatives, one that Representative Reardon just spoke to, is this notion of providing some additional bump for parents with very young children. That idea originated out of a study that was advanced by Richard Murnane of Harvard University and Greg Duncan, University of California, Irvine, two prominent early childhood experts, and they were posed the question, if you had two things to do in early childhood education to get kids ready for school, what would they be? One of them was high-quality pre-kindergarten along the lines of the program that's running in Boston, Massachusetts. And the second one was taking the EITC and increasing it for families with very young children. And the argument on the EITC push had to do with just the sort of the capacity that families with very young children who are living with low incomes have to make day-to-day decisions, and that in their research and the research of others, they found that that extra bump of a couple $3,000 a year makes a huge difference. Some have characterized living in poverty as, you know, for those who aren't living in poverty, trying to work with a cell phone or a smartphone that only has a battery capacity of 6%. You're constantly trying to figure out how to recharge and stay online and do your business. It's very taxing, and that extra amount of money makes a huge difference, as Representative Reardon made reference to, impacts on health, impacts on education, impacts on labor force participation. So unequivocal, great piece of public policy. The other piece is the outreach piece, and I'm going to be brief on that because I can see that Chuck's loaded to go on that one right now. But Oregon is at the tail end of the distribution in terms of the share who are eligible who actually take it up. And for me, it's really perplexing because this is a state that has the highest participation rate in the country for food stamp participation. So somehow, in some way, in social services, this state has figured out how to do outreach well for that particular piece of public policy, and we're on the exact opposite end of the distribution for this one. So for that one, I'll turn it over to Chuck to push a little harder there.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Chuck Shekhtoff, Oregon Center for Public Policy. I submitted a number of things to the record. I neglected, however, to submit our paper that we released last November, and I will send it to the committee staff, looking at the IRS data on participation. And as John said, we are last, and we've been last or near the last for the last few years. I'm perplexed by it, too. I will say, allude to it in the paper, that it's not really clear their process for figuring out, it's pretty complicated, the data sources they're using to figure out participation. So we may not be actually one, but we're certainly not 50th, I mean, but we're certainly not one or 25. We're down at the bottom. So it's not, and it's perplexing. I think in relation to food stamps, it's a great issue. When I think John, we hired John when he first got back to Oregon at Echo Northwest to do a couple studies for us. There were some of the centers for early studies, and one of them was on, he analyzed what would happen in Oregon if we did a food stamp outreach program similar to the pilot projects that were being done by USDA around the country. And he ranked the pilot project results low, medium, high performance, and then projected what would we do if we did low, medium, high here, how many more food stamps we'd bring in. And that report led to decisions to have an outreach program in the state. And the Department of Human Services took that on. And that's, I think, why we went to the top or near the top on food stamp use, because we do aggressive outreach and it's a state agency responsibility. One of the documents I gave you is a thick packet with a cover memo that I prepared for an informal work group meeting that Chair Geyer called together to talk about the issue. And as I note in there, the first and foremost thing that needs to happen on outreach is we need a state agency involved. Years ago, before Cache Oregon was up and running, we did some outreach with some national nonprofits, did posters, we did PSAs with governors and the like. But then Cache Oregon has really ramped it up and is doing outreach and doing doing the returns for people. But there really needs to be a state agency involved. State government touches many, many lives in many different ways and can very easily facilitate outreach. So one example is related to all the good work you all did on child care credits last session is the Department of Education's Office of Child Care should be telling and requiring child care providers who they regulate, we want you periodically to tell your customers that they should hang on to their receipts, otherwise they'll fail on a review by the Department of Revenue. Tell them that they can get a child care tax credit and tell them they can maybe get an EITC, because those are people who would likely use it. And I think having a business, a child care provider, have to tell their customers that information isn't an onerous regulation. I think it's good for our economy and good for our state. There's a whole bunch of agencies. When people get unemployment insurance, that means someone being on unemployment insurance might have been not income eligible for the EITC, but if they're going to be on unemployment for a good part of the year, they may become eligible. They should be told by the employment agency, you're getting taxed on your unemployment insurance. You might qualify for the work income you had earlier in the year. You may qualify for the earned income tax credit. So, you know, I just think a whole bunch of agencies should do that. As far as the materials I've submitted, there's a couple articles that were written, one in Bloomberg and then Vox, which is an online site, did, talking about the importance of about this study that was done out of California where they looked at about 35,000 returns and they looked at different ways of contacting people to get them to, who had not, these are 35,000 people who looked on paper to their Department of Revenue and the IRS that they probably could have qualified for the EITC and had not applied. And they test in this, and the paper's also included in the record. And the bottom line is, if you do repeated messages, simple messages, both in text size and wide spacing and language, as well as telling people, don't use the word tax, telling people what they're going to get, the dollar figure, and how fast it is, it works as far as getting people to apply and get the TITC. And I don't think there's any reason why our Department of Revenue, working with the IRS, can't do that and can't, and at a minimum, start the process of sending people follow-up notices with instructions on how to file the amended state and federal returns and get that money coming into Oregon. There's some other studies I submitted. There's one called Nudges and Learning. One of the things it talks about is that, yes, you can get people to do it. Do they have long-term? If you do it once for this family, are they going to remember to do it the next year? Maybe not. People aren't learning about the tax system, but they can learn to file now, and I think it's important. And then there was a study out of Virginia. IRS did do some pilot projects, and that's what the California one was based on. We have yet to find sort of a good summary of all the different pilot project data and stuff, and I think you can find that. I think it's really important that you do target outreach, and that's clear. I've included in the record a case study by Civis Analytics. They were engaged by people trying to, by the group that was trying to assure most people would apply for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, eligible, the uninsured. And they used big data and data from state and local government to help target the outreach for the ACA, and that case study explains how successful they were. Civis Analytics has contacted the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, D.C., who in turn contacted us and others in our network and said they're ready, willing, and able. They know that there's a problem with the earned income tax credit. They would love to work with state government at figuring out how to target the outreach so that we can do that with a small nonprofit like Cache Oregon might not be able to afford and may not be able to handle, but state government could, and then really target the outreach. And that's, I think that is important to do. So thank you, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you.
That you're taking.
Thank you for the study that got the fire going under us. 73% is our uptake, approximately, and I think your study said something like $524 million is what is returned to Oregonians. A lot of that is in rural areas, goes directly into their pocket to use in local economies, and we leave something like $126 million on the table that could be coming. And that is just the federal EITC. That's not the state. It's also not the federal child tax credit. It's also not the federal and state child independent care. So the federal EITC is the big one, but whatever we do, we should be thinking about all the tax credits that would help low-income families. Thank you for the study.
Well, thank you.
And for all your ideas.
Bob. Good afternoon. My name is Rob Justice. I'm the executive director of Cache Oregon. Cache Oregon is a very small little nonprofit that exists to promote free tax preparation. We do that in partnership with AARP Tax Aid. I'm not sure if you're real familiar with AARP Tax Aid, but it is a 100% volunteer effort to provide free tax preparation throughout the state. The difficult thing with that approach is that you're completely reliant on volunteers. One of the things Cache Oregon did starting 10 years ago is to partner with Tax Aid to help grow their program. And we've done that. Actually, we've quadrupled the number of tax returns that the volunteer program has done, especially within the last 5 years. Last year, we did close to 55,000 tax returns and interacted with, in total, additional 23,000 individuals in helping them figure out how to get their return done. Our focus historically and more recently has really been trying to create that infrastructure to recruit the volunteers, to have computers, to really have that opportunity for people to file and to assist people. We feel pretty good about what we've done to date, but we recognize that it doesn't even come close to scratching the need. And to describe that need, I actually want to tell you a story. And it's a good example of what we've seen of folks coming into our tax sites. We actually, Cache Oregon, does taxes year-round because the demand is that great, especially since the IRS has stopped helping folks file returns. It was probably the end of April, 1st of May, a couple of years ago, we had a woman come in. She introduced herself. You could tell emotionally she was pretty upset. And she said, I was told by 211 that I could come here to get help to file a tax return. Yes. She says, well, I'm embarrassed. I'm kind of humiliated. But I haven't filed a return, in over 3 years. And the reason why I'm here today is because my son wants to file for FAFSA because he wants to go to college. And I can't do a FAFSA application without my tax return. So, we started asking some questions. Well, why haven't you filed? She told us a long story about she went through a divorce. It was very complicated, but when she had filed, something went awry, and she got a very, as she described it, mean letter from the Department of Revenue. She says, and to be honest, they freaked me out. I read that letter, and all I could think is, they're going to take my home, or they're going to take my kids. She says, and I know I wasn't rational, but I threw away the letter, and I haven't filed since. And now today I'm here, and she started to cry because my son wants to go to college, and I don't have the money send him to college. But I do think that, you know, there are, you know, if we apply to some financial aids because we don't have a lot of money, that could happen. We actually spent a lot of months working with her to get right with the IRS and Department of Revenue. The interesting thing, as we finally did go back and were able to file her tax returns because of the EITC, she actually had some real money coming back to her. And it completely transformed, you know, her life in a dramatic way. Mm. For me, that story embodies a couple different things. One, we absolutely, there's a need to do more outreach and education to folks in the community about the value of EITC and the value of actually filing your taxes. One of the things we talked about with very low-income people who maybe technically don't feel like or need to file, but if they did, even a family made $2,500, then they could document that. That family might get close to $1,000 back in a federal EITC. So the need for all low-income people to file that return, regardless of whether they think they need to or not. So that outreach is important. The other component to this effort is, you know, a broader system than what we have now with our volunteers to help people file their taxes. And I don't know how you file your taxes. Most people I talk to, you know, are having somebody else do it for them. Or those who are brave enough are filing online. But how do we help people file their taxes? So it's one thing, well, you should do it and you could get this EITC. But, you know, what does that look like? There are today some tools that exist that I really think can transform the availability and how we reach out to folks to file. The best example of that is on the Department of Revenue's website. It is Free File. Free File is an alliance of several software companies that where the IRS have negotiated with them to provide free software, both for filing federal and state, for lower income folks. The links to, you know, what, 6 or 7 of those software systems are on the Department of Revenue's website, though you wouldn't know it.
They're actually not right now.
Well, they're down because we're
in
transition.
Right.
Yeah, actually, probably in about a week, they'll come online. But the tool's there. You know, but do people know about it? How, you know, are we helping people utilize it? So I think so these are all questions, and I do believe that, you know, with a real concentrated effort, and I actually agree with Chuck, I like the idea that there is a state agency that takes charge and really looks and monitors, because whatever we do, you know, today and tomorrow, we have to be able to measure it. We have to be able to point to say, you know, we did these 5 things, and 3 years from now, we saw an increase. So I think that data, that tracking, and to be able to measure that is critical in moving forward. I also think, you know, providing free tax preparation, the outreach, the other is really looking at the Department of Revenue and how it communicates to folks. And what I have described as somewhat of a mean-spirited interaction that, to me, you know, for a lot of folks who are very low income, you know, like this woman, I mean, it freaked me out, you know. And, you know, and you talk to the Department of Revenue, oh, what's a standard letter? We say that to everybody. Well, that's, you know, we know the emotional impact. And when you're talking about income in money with folks, specifically folks who don't have a lot of it, you know, it's a very emotional issue. And so the better we can do to help people see a critical path, even if there's a mistake made, to be able to rectify that rather than threatening their existence. So part of looking at how we are going to change the way we do business is looking at the Department of Revenue. And also, you know, as Chuck was saying, how we communicate to, you know, the literally tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of low-income folks that the state interacts with today. So I'm looking forward in moving forward, you know, in looking on how we can be more strategic and thoughtful in helping low-income people file their taxes.
Great. Thank you very much. Any questions?
I just have one question. I appreciate you coming in, and I'm so thankful that your organization exists to help people do their taxes. It's very important, and of course, we want everyone participating in the economy and filing their taxes. I've always been curious, the phrase earned income tax credit, I mean, I know what that means, of course. I don't think it makes sense to people. And so when people say, oh, well, people aren't filing for it, I just wonder, in your experience, when you sit down with folks, I just think the choice of, not you didn't come up with it, of course, but the choice of these terms are just so foreign.
Tax credits in general, people eyes gloss over.
Of course.
So we have tried to, and we actually have a flyer that's available on our website that's used quite a bit that gets more to realize you could have hundreds or thousands of dollars coming back to you. And more of that emphasis on getting people to actually file. What's great about the software...
Hundreds or thousands, hundreds of thousands, right? Okay, just want to make sure.
Yeah, sorry. Woohoo! But what the great thing about the software that's available is if you follow the questions within that software and you're eligible for any tax credit, you're going to get it.
Right.
It is really trying to channel folks to that. But it is interesting, I mean, how we talk about EITC as this thing. I really try to emphasize, one, it starts with filing your taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And if we get more and more people to do that, and what is happening, which is to our benefit, is the IRS, they're doing away with paper. So you are going to be forced to, you know, when you file your taxes, it's either going to be electronic or you're going to be doing it with somebody. So in that really forces the issue where, you know, if somebody's eligible, especially using the software, they're going to get that credit.
Yeah, it just seems that we should have some sort of link as you're going through that you can click, and then it defines it so that it's, you know, any kind of term that, I mean, you know, there could be some sort of template so that you could just click, and then it would say, this means this, so that people could maybe start to understand it, because I just can't help to think that that's one of the barriers with so many of the financial issues is people just not knowing what the terms mean.
Sure. One of the things we just put on our website to try to kind of help people with that is an EITC calculator.
Great.
So trying to that push folks and say, you know, even before you do your taxes, here's a simple calculator that you can plug a couple things in, and oh, boom, look, you're going to get $2,000.
Mm-hmm. So just to let you know, I have a LC on this, and it may be on OLIS or may not for today's. It was what I submitted for November 24th, and we met after that date to come up with some ideas. So the ideas in the LC were just a teeny bit of a framework. We're going to put more meat on the bones. A lot of that is designating a state agency. The work group decided that DHS really made the most sense because they have self-sufficiency programs. They have people applying for TANF. They have DHS offices around the county. They connect with different agencies, so it made sense to make them responsible, and I'm glad to see the director of self-sufficiency and the director of DHS here. So they were not, you know, who knows whether they were a willing participant or not, but that's what we thought made the most sense. It used to be Housing and Community Services that took the lead on it because the Interagency Task Force on Hunger, maybe not saying the name right, used to be placed in that. And so Representative Nancy Nathanson did have a bill in 2009 holding that agency responsible, but it sunsetted after 2 years. So the idea on this bill is that there would not be a sunset. We would be asking them to come forward with a plan of asking for a task force that would be headed up by DHS, and it would be attended by Oregon Health Authority, Housing and Community Services, Department of Education because of Office of Child Care. The Department of Revenue clearly needs to be a really important player at the table, and we need more collaboration with the Department of Revenue. So there may be some specific requests of Department of Revenue. We are going to hear from DHS and Department of Revenue next, but these are some of the ideas that were generated that you will not see in the LC yet, only because we're scrambling to get our requests back in. So, you know, stay tuned, and we would love your ideas on developing this. Thank you for all the ideas that you've given today.
Okay, sure.
Do you want to ask one of them? Sorry.
Yeah, that'd be, okay.
Yes, sorry. Come back. We'll open it to another question.
Thank you. I just want to take advantage of the great economic minds sitting at the table. Could you contrast the effects that EITC has on reducing poverty compared to increasing the minimum wage?
Okay. In 3 minutes or less?
Again, John DePonia with Echo Northwest. The EITC is clearly deeply targeted because it is it's focused on only folks who are either in poverty or just above it. And now you're going to get into a technicality. The federal measure of poverty, the traditional one, doesn't count the EITC, so simply giving them the EITC doesn't sort of change that technical historic federal poverty measure, but it would. There are supplemental ones that would take credits into effect, and it has an impact there. Minimum wage is more diffuse. There are going to be people above and below the line that receive the minimum wage. I think Congressional Budget Office, when they looked nationally and they were looking at potential changes to the federal minimum wage, there are puts and takes, potential unemployment effects, but on net, I think they anticipated some reduction in poverty. I would say on balance, obviously there are fiscal consequences because you have to fund an EITC, that it is a more targeted approach to poverty reduction.
Let me ask one question because maybe you can answer that while you're answering his too. I'm curious because EITC has a kind of an umbrella. You know, the more you make, the more you get as a tax credit, and then it starts leveling back down. And I'm wondering if you've done any study to say as incomes go up because wages go up, does that actually bring in more federal EITC dollars or not? I mean, you have to look at the population and try to figure that out. But that would be – that's an interesting
– You also lose benefits also.
Correct. So, but you can, yeah, I'm wondering. You could go either way.
Yeah. So as far as lifting people out of poverty, the minimum wage does more. It helps more people. It helps more people who have no children, and it helps. And it's lifting their income before taxes. As John said, your EITC doesn't affect that. So for instance. So how does that affect policymakers? So back when President Obama was pushing 10-10 for national minimum wage, a study out of UC Berkeley, I believe, said that if you raise the minimum wage to 10-10. There'd be lower spending on food stamps than the most draconian cut proposed in Congress. So if you take the, frankly, it was a Republican cut, most draconian cut to food stamps, now called SNAP, so we really know what they are, it would do more than that because people would be lifted out of poverty. John's other point is spot on. It's who, if you're saying, well, I just want to help low-income working people, who should pay for that? Should it be the government and our taxes and we have to contribute it, or should it be the employers? And it's an issue of they're not getting paid enough. And so we think you need to do both. We don't think you can ignore the EITC. In many states over the last 10 years that I've been following, 10 to 20 years I've been following this, when there's been EITs, when there's been minimum wage debates, some people in the business community, frankly, come in and say, no, just raise the EITC. They want everybody else to pay for it. But it doesn't lift people out of poverty.
Pay taxes, too.
So, I mean, if you want to lift workers out of poverty, you raise the minimum wage.
Can you cite some references?
I'll get you that. I don't have it in my head, but I know there because there's been a lot of research on it, and they should do both.
Can I follow up?
Sure, follow up.
And when you're talking about poverty, how come you don't consider both the wage and also the net benefits, including government-provided benefits?
Well, that's – and John can probably talk about more than me about it. There's for years, they've been looking at a supplemental poverty measure that would look at benefits. And – there was an old, like maybe 15, 20 years ago, there was a National Academy of Sciences study and panel that was looking at it. And now, actually, the Census Department, every fall when they release the poverty numbers, they are also releasing what it would be under a sort of working definition of supplemental poverty. They sort of haven't landed on one that's agreed upon. But what it would, you know, if you change the poverty definition, it changes a whole host of federal programs and stuff. So I'm not so sure someone's going to, it makes it more complicated, frankly. So I'm not so sure someone's going to do that. But the supplemental poverty measure is being published now every year because it does show the important role of the subsidy programs.
One more follow-up. No, I'll be
last one, and then I want to make sure we get to the next panel.
Isn't the case in Oregon decrease the minimum wage until you get to around $15 to $16 an hour? People are essentially neutral or lose net benefits and pay. But as the pay goes, as your minimum wage goes up, you lose benefits. So the net on net is essentially a decrease, or it's no significant increase up to about 15, 16. I think actually
depends on number of dependents.
Well, I can speak to that. I asked our own fiscal office to generate that report. Right. And at $15 an hour, not to include the loss of health care, the net increase after you lose, fall off the benefits cliff was $49 a month. Yeah. And you're shaking our head, sir, but that is who we should be relying on for our information is the people downstairs who are nonpartisan staff. So
if that's true from our own legislative fiscal office, why wouldn't EITC have more impact than increasing the minimum wage in Oregon?
Madam Chair and Representative Bueller, because it's not true. So that study, and
you're saying legislative fiscal office is
a legislative
revenue
office is doing inaccurate work in counseling the legislature inaccurately on a key issue.
Madam Chair and Representative Bueller, I'll submit to the record our response to their thing as well as our paper on the benefit cliff. Here's who that $49 was calculated as. It was for someone among the very small number. It's less than 3,000. I shouldn't say that. It's a very small number of people who are in the ERDC program, and they had made assumptions about getting that child care credit. The vast majority, the ERD, Employment-Related Daycare Program, is a teeny program. The vast majority of minimum wage workers are not getting ERDC subsidy. And the ERDC subsidy in the manual at the time that study was done said the copayment should go up when the income goes up, but not so much to overcome the income gain. So the problem was that you have an agency, the Department of Human Services, with a rule that didn't follow their manual, and you had Legislative Revenue Office, who are not the Legislative Fiscal Office and are not that familiar with all the public benefits, do a study of one type of family that might be affected. If you read our benefits cliff paper, you'll see that there are some potholes in the system where your income goes up and you don't get the gains. And there's certainly, you're losing some. There's a tax on your income gains. There's no question about that. But low-income people do not like having to be on public assistance. And it's not in the interest of the state and our economy to have more people on public assistance. Okay? And, you know, in the ideal world, everyone's earning enough. And the only people on public assistance are those who can't work because of age or disability. Right? And so if you want to lift people out of poverty, you raise the wage. And that's better for the economy to do that.
So I'm going to close it off now because this could go on for hours. I invite you to invite our esteemed economists to your offices to talk more about them. I think it's one of the problems with the studies is it depends on whether people work 20 hours, 30 hours, 40 hours, whether they have several children. It's really hard to encapsulate. The ERDC serves somewhere between 16 and 20%. So there's a lot of different factors here. I don't think it's something that we're going to solve right here. But
Chair, that study just so you know, did not include the loss of the OHP, which they absolutely would at $15, and only the children would be able to stay on Healthy Kids. So when you factor in the loss of health care access under the Medicaid, under OHP, we're talking about a very substantial hit, and they did not choose to factor that in because of just how difficult it would be to sort of get that quantified, but in the time frame I asked.
But it's difficult because if you have a certain number of children, you fall into the federal poverty line more quickly, even if you're earning the same amount, and so you may still qualify for it. It also depends on how many hours you're working a week. There's a many, many different factors. So I think studies have shown that the majority of people benefit greatly when you raise the wage. There are going to be certain circumstances where they fall off certain cliffs.
But $15 an hour, yeah, and no dependents, and working full-time, which we hope people work,
yes,
they're not qualified for OHP any longer.
That's right, and I would argue they probably shouldn't.
They're not qualified.
We're saving our public dollars for
they're not qualified. They're at the minimum wage today, they're not qualified. The minimum wage today for a two-person family lifts you out of poverty.
So we're not going to solve the minimum wage debate right here. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. But we have one more panel on the EITC. So DHS and Department of Revenue folks, Dr. Reginald Richardson, Mr. Ken Ross, and Deanna Mack, please. Thank you. Dr. Richardson, would you like to start?
Yes, Chair Kenny Geyer and the rest of the committee. I'm still Dr. Reginald Richardson. I'm the director of the Office of Self-Sufficiency Programs for DHS. About a week ago, the chair facilitated a work group meeting which we were invited to participate, and was asked if DHS would become the lead agency around tax credits, what would we need and how would we do it. And so we have submitted a draft proposal that you should have, and I'd be happy to take any questions that you might have. It is really a plan that emphasizes trying to study the problem to make sure that we are coming up with solutions that fit the targeted population that we're concerned about. It would request that you give us the actual authority to create a steering group comprised of a number of the state agencies that the chair has already mentioned. We would also contract with an expert organization to be able to deliver the kind of expert material development, the looking at best practices across the country, ensuring that our outreach strategies will be effective and sustainable. And then we would report back our findings and recommendations for a longer term process to make sure that not only the federal and our state tax credits will be sustainable in helping our low-income families. And so at this point, I'd be happy to take any questions that you have.
Any questions for Dr. Richardson? Thank you for such quick turnaround on your
You're welcome.
Work. Really appreciate that. Okay. Department of Revenue.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Deanna Mack, and I'm with the Department of Revenue, and we were asked yesterday to come to the hearing to talk about some of the things we do, I think, with the Earned Income Tax Credit, and I put together a quick PowerPoint. It has some high-level overviews of, you know, the things that qualify for the Earned Income Tax Credit. I think a lot of the panelists ahead of me actually talked about some of the things that we've done in the past to partner with Cash Oregon and the tax aid, the AARP program, tax aid, back, I think, in 2009 or 10 to get information shared. We do have the free file. I think you'll see on one of the slides, we do have the free file initiative for low-income folks to be able to file tax returns. Currently, over 94% of taxpayers file tax returns electronically, and I think someone already mentioned that the tax return software does walk you through the process of calculating and seeing your eligibility for certain tax return type items, whatever those might be. The earn income tax credit. Over 97% of them are filed using software, claimed using software. So that's better than the state average. It is a complex credit. It deals specifically with a lot of personal family relationship issues that we don't know or have access to until we do an audit. I don't know what it sounds like. You want us to do more outreach to folks on the tax credits. On this particular tax credit, we do put information on our website. We do partner with other agencies. We are currently working with DHS on their Oregon, I think it's Oregon Eligibility One website, to provide information to the Earned Income Tax Credit assistant that the IRS puts out, so that people can determine their eligibility if they are not required to file a return, since software does that for them if they are. As a matter of course, if we have to adjust a taxpayer's return in processing, the adjustment will go in either direction. If they are entitled to a $500 tax credit and they claim $50, we'll make that adjustment. It can go in either direction. One of every $3 of adjustments that we make is in favor of the taxpayer, so I don't want you to think that we're only dinging people on these situations. But they are very. This is a pretty complex credit, and there is a high error rate within it. I do have that information in the slide as well. So I guess we're just here. I brought Ken Ross with me, the program manager for the Personal Income Tax Program. He's responsible for all credits and subtractions and deductions and the administration of the return process system. So if you have any questions about anything else the department does or can do, we're happy to partner with DHS to get more information out there if that's what you desire.
Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. Thank you, Deanna, for being here. Deanna and I have worked a lot on some different bills, and you know, things are changing at the Department of Revenue. Not fast enough, maybe, but there is on the verge of a new day. We're trying to help them improve, and they've been through a lot, and we're trying to help them get back on track together. And on this issue of the Earned Income Tax Credit, and you're just talking about it, that it's complex. What could be done? What can we do in your, because you deal with all these different credits that are coming through, and of course I've been through with all the Gentex, and you're having this new software that's coming in that's going to radically change things. We've spent, was it $60 million on a new system for the Department of Revenue? There's going to be all these changes coming in, and because there's going to be the new computer system, is there something we can do to make it a little
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, the credit is about as simple as you can make it for Oregon purposes. It's okay. A straight percentage of the federal. It's the federal rules that are so complex.
Okay.
The federal rules require that they can't have an ITIN. They have to have a Social Security number. The children have to have a Social Security number, which we don't necessarily know that information. We don't know housing situations where there's maybe multiple working adults in a household. Necessarily that may or may not be eligible to claim. We don't know where custodial parents, where the child is living more than half the year with a custodial parent or a non-custodial parent. There's divorce, there's non-traditional family situations that we don't know. I mean, I think people think we know everything about everything that they do, but we really don't know about their personal, especially their marital situations. And this credit, this particular credit, is heavily based on that those scenarios. And those are all federal rules.
Okay.
So I would just say, and then I hope that you will have an opportunity to say something too, that one of the things that came up in the discussion about how do we increase, given that by at least one study we're dead last, and all those kinds of things that you talked about are the same in other states, you know, what is it that we can do? There's a customer service element. There's a simplicity element. I've been on the DOR, and I welcome all of you to go on it right now and see if you can find, without going to the search, EITC, because sometimes people may not know how to use that search function. But, you know, if you go on and click onto it right now, see if you can find the page with the free tax filing or information about EITC. It's very, very buried in there for and if one of our goals, if we know that we're leaving $126 million, federal dollars, on the, and of course this is a state, right, but it's attached to the federal, you know, what is it that we can do if you see your role as more than one of strictly compliance, but one as, we are
a department in Oregon here to serve the people of Oregon. And one of the interpretations of that service is, how do we help people file taxes, or encourage them, or lead them in a direction where they file taxes to make sure that they get money that they're entitled to back in their pockets. So I think that it's, you know, it's a cultural shift. It's, there's some technical things that we could do, and I think that we would really like to have a, you know, we in the legislature, I'm proposing, would like to see a working relationship between departments where we align our missions more in that kind of direction, that that becomes part of the mission of the Department of Revenue.
Right. And Madam Chair, and this alludes to something Representative Taylor talked about. We, on December 1st, we just actually updated our website. The entire website was changed. So some of the information that at one time was on the very front page, like our free file, is now not probably where it should be. So we accept, we need to hear feedback like that, because we did just go through a major, just a month ago, revamp of that website because of our core system replacement project. So we're aware of some issues with that. We're happy to move stuff around if we can. And we're definitely happy to work with the Department of Human Services on educating taxpayers. That's one of our goals. We educate, we assist, and we also enforce. We don't advocate. I think we've talked about that before, for any of the tax credits or anything, but we do educate and tell people that it's available.
Right.
And we're more than willing to provide links to information on how
or the
to file.
Volunteer, like
yeah,
the cash
absolutely.
Oregon.
We do now.
I couldn't find that on there.
It's the page is it is a little buried. I found it last night. It's actually the middle box. It says file for filing information now in the new form. You have to link into it, but we're happy to make it a little more visible. E-file, electronic filing doesn't open until next week. I think someone else alluded to the fact that mentioned that the next week it'll be, that information will be on our website, because none of the software vendors are allowing anyone to file. The IRS doesn't allow anyone to file until next week, and so they don't provide information to those software vendors until then. So that's part of the issue. But Ken is here. He's hearing firsthand what it is you need to hear from folks on our website, and make sure that they get the information that you need us to hear.
And Mr. Rass, I'd love to hear any words that you have about things that you think could work. I don't know how long you've been in this department, what may have worked in the past that we're not doing anymore, or ideas that you might have.
Representative Kenny Geyer, Ken Ross with the Department of Revenue. I've been with the department a long time, actually. It's, and alluding to Representative Taylor, that we're trying to shift. We're a big ship. It takes time. Historically, that hasn't been our focus. Our focus is administration. We administer the tax laws. We provide the format, the forms, the instructions to get people to file. We haven't been a promoter of any type of credit or whatever might be available. We put the information out there. It's, in one hand, it feels a little awkward to be promoting something and then we turn around and say, well, we're going to audit that. It puts us in a little bit of an awkward situation. With our new system that Gentax got mentioned, we do have the ability to do more things, be more nimble. If you are out there, if you're looking at our forms and you just love looking at our tax forms, you'll notice that in 15, they're drastically different, and we're collecting more information. We're actually collecting dependent information, so that we will have the ability to tell more, so we would be able to partner if we have the ability to share that information. Obviously, we have to worry about disclosure type
stuff.
So
I know that you added some things. I think that's good, and you always have only a certain amount of things that you can fit. Is it true that the EITC box actually came out off the form this year?
Chair Kenny Geyer, it is true, and that it'll be back next year. It's on a schedule. We had to make room for the kicker, and so that was the line we pulled off. It will be back next year.
But, Madam Chair, just to clarify, the form, all of the tax credits are on a schedule on the back. Most of the less commonly used for credits and deductions, additions, subtractions, all those are on a schedule. So they still have access. It's all, most of it is software prepared. It will automatically fill those fields and come forward to a carry forward, a summary box on the front of the return. So while it's not on the on page two, it's on the schedule, and the software will calculate it and bring it forward. So they're not going to not see it. 97% of these folks are using software. Software calculates this automatically for them. So it'll just bring it forward into a
summary box on the on page two for all of the rest of the credits, including that one.
Excuse me, Chair Kindergarten. Perhaps may I make a suggestion when we when we're back, and maybe we could have a demonstration of the software to see how this actually works. I could paper copy is one thing, but of course, since we're moving to electronic, you know, it seems.
Madam Chair and Representative Taylor, we do not have any one software that we prepare. There are several software vendors in the state that I'm sure would love to share their products with you. And many of them test with us, and are we know that they are sharing the correct information, that what they send us is what we expect to receive. And then we approve their software. But there's half a dozen or more, I think, that we approve, maybe a dozen, that we approve for filing with Oregon.
Yeah, I heard. I think I heard seven that are both DOR and IRS approved. That if and if people are under a certain income level, then they're automatically free.
And yeah, Madam Chair, there's most of the software vendors work with the Free File Alliance through the IRS and the various states to provide free service, free filing for. Folks who are in lower income brackets. I believe the threshold, the highest amount this year is $62,000, somewhere around there, $62,000 adjusted gross income test. So anyone who falls below that threshold, students, elderly, anyone low income can file for free for both the federal and the state.
Okay, Representative Evans?
Yeah, it's a comment and a question and a request all wrapped into one with a bow. $178 million. Is that what I heard?
$126 million. Federal. That's only the federal EITC.
Okay, that's being left on the table.
Yeah.
$4 billion every year is being left on the table, or more, from the 250,000 veterans that currently aren't receiving a benefit one. I say that because I'm glad we have a process, and we should have a process to try to track down folks and help them get their benefits they receive. I think that's a Jim Dandy idea. $4 billion is currently not there. And in terms of economics, I don't see the rich people fighting the war. It's the working class, like it always has been, fighting the war. So if we want to actually help the folks that are in this tax bracket, in this environment, odds are one or more of them probably has somebody in the service because they couldn't find a job or they couldn't have opportunities, so they went. So I highly recommend, if we're going to be doing targeted outreach for capturing dollars that are set aside by the feds, we don't let it get siloed like we do so many things in this building. We recognize the more information is helpful to realize those dollars and that help. So my request is, when you start looking at electronic forms for the future, please make sure the simple question of, are you a vet, is in there. I notice by statute, because we helped pass that law, that ODVA's moniker is on your website. That said, in the past, when I've looked at forms, there hasn't really been an emphasis on that always. I request that that continue forward. Thank you.
Can I ask a question about that? Since I use a tax software question, the TurboTax, right, when I do my taxes, and they do ask the question, are you a member of the armed forces? If you're telling me that, you know, we can work with vendors who can put information in the forms, what would it take to ask, you know, have you served? Not just are you a member, but have you served? Like we've done No Wrong Door in a whole bunch of other agencies, DMV, DHS, and then procure that information back from the Department of Revenue for the purpose that Representative Evans is talking about, an identification of folks that we need to be doing outreach with, because it's probably closer to $5 billion being left on the table if you talk to Cameron Smith at ODVA.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Parrish, I know that I'm sure that we have contacts with software companies that we're happy to share with you if you are interested in reaching out to them. The information that comes in on a tax return, though, is protected and confidential information, so we are bound to not share that with folks. So if you probably don't want to tie it to the tax return for that reason. You want to have it come through the software vendors in some other way than the tax return. Maybe they can have it send you a data file or, I don't know, to get that information to you. would be my guess. The TurboTax asked that question because for Oregon, we have a subtraction for military folks. You know, if you are working outside of Oregon, then you don't have to pay taxes on your military income. And if you work inside Oregon, you have a subtraction up to $6,000.
So
that's why the software vendors ask that question when they go through that interview. But I don't know that that information then can be taken from a tax return and shared with anyone else because it's from our administrative purposes, it's confidential.
Because of statute?
It is because of statute.
State statute or federal statute?
State statute.
So that's, again, something we could look at changing.
Actually, it's both. I think it's federal and it's the IRS and our exchange of information agreement and federal tax information is also confidential. And if we do not guarantee that that information is maintained in its confidential nature here, we lose access to federal information, and we don't want to have to lose access.
I don't want their tax
federal.
Return. I just want the ancillary information that they would check the box for our state, which we could maybe statutorily
and now I think you can work with the software vendors on getting that information as long as it's not part of the tax record.
Okay. Well, thank you. Lots of good ideas. Lots of good ways to get people get money back here to the people that most need it. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
I want to switch the order quickly before we see Director Psyche and see if Representative Hayden, you would like to just quickly say what your bill is because it's related to tax credits. Would you like to do it from here or down here?
I'll get on the record.
We only have one person who is introducing a personal bill on the human service side.
But he's going to look good doing it.
That's true.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. My name is Cedric Hayden, State Representative from House District 7. I will be brief here. This LC 81 is something that I worked on with partners last session, and it's coming up again. We have a strong bipartisan support, and it's a fairly simple concept that has some technical aspects to it that will work with the Department of Human Services and the Department of Revenue. We're starting out with an ask for a pilot project that will simply identify patients, not patients, that will simply identify clients that have had a tax credit accredited to them over the last 12-month period or on their last tax filing. And so that tax filing will be a precursor or a pre-qualification for this program. And let's take a simple example of, say, they got $2,400 tax credit for child care with their family. They go down to file their TurboTax or some sort of rapid refund. They pay about 10%, maybe 15%. So owe that $2,400 that they receive for a child care, it turns into $2,000, and then they receive that somewhere around April 15th, 16th, or 17th, all in one lump sum. The intent by our taxing system is that that money will be to reimburse for their child care that they either spent for the entire prior year or that they're going to save that for the next 12 months so that their child can have the best possible care. I think there's a flaw in that assumption that money will either be reimbursed because the child care provider can simply not provide care for free for a year. And I don't think it's a realistic expectation that those monies will be saved for 12 months forward. And so the simple solution is to work with some systems that we already have in place through the SNAP, very similar to the TANF system, where these clients have an existing, basically a debit card. Where a cash benefit can be put onto that at relatively little cost to the state, and the Department of Revenue will identify these clients. They say that they got $2,400 last year, so month to month, we're assuming with the current system of being qualified for 12 months, that they will be qualified for another 12 months, and so they will receive a $200 cash benefit through this debit card system that they already have, and with the intent for that to be paid out to their child care in the month that they need the child care. Keep in mind that these tax credits are from income that these people worked for. They are low-income families, and they need the cash flow to take care of their children at the time that their children are growing up. And there is a continuity from the year prior. Most of these families will still have those children the next year. And so we want to make the cash available to them when they need it. It will help increase the quality of the child care that they have and decrease the inefficiency of paying a rapid refund and getting all of the money up at once, and decrease the likelihood that that money will not go to child care and might go to something that's needed. It might go to a car repair. It might go to a dishwasher. But my focus is to get the best quality child care that we can for those children. Thank you.
Great. Quick question?
Well, just more comment. First of all, thanks for coming in and tackling this in your freshman year. I have to say, if you haven't looked at this bill, please do. I think it's one of the most innovative things that we can do to get money into the hands of people. They were going to get the money one way or the other, but it's not just about protecting them from a rapid refund loan type situation where they're going to lose a chunk of what was their return. So that money's just going off to some private corporation. It's not just that they're going to have the cash flow that they can for the daycare, but if you can't make your expenses, you're talking about people who maybe are also in a situation with a high interest credit card. And, you know, this is affecting credit scores. It's affecting whether or not they can afford to stay in their house. If they can't, you know, do you pay rent and work and or do you do daycare and not have it, miss work, lose your house? So the fact that we can potentially put, you know, a lot of money into people's hands, and there is a reconciliation piece in this. If we overpaid, it gets adjusted in the next tax return. But so the state's not going to be out money for this. It's just a different way to cash flow something we're already doing and putting it in the people's hands when they need it. Wish we would have done it in 15. Let's get this done in 16, please. I think it's a great test case for us.
Thank you for your comments.
And one follow-up comment is, yep, the reason it's a small pilot project, and I was encouraged, and this has strong bipartisan support on the co-sponsorship of it, the chief sponsorship. One thing I was encouraged was to include the EITC, and I wanted to wait because I wanted to get the system figured out and perfected with a population that we can get that money back to them that is already existing, so there wasn't a high administrative burden to make this happen. And once that's in place, I see the potential for this expanding significantly and really transforming the way that we provide cash assistance to our low-income families in Oregon. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. I share your enthusiasm for this. Thank you very much. Okay, so last up, Mr. Clyde Psyche, to give us an overall report. You were not able to come to us last time we had a hearing. Of course, we've heard a lot about the child welfare system in the news, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to give a general update about the department, whatever you'd like to say about that issue. I know that Senator Gelser is really focusing on it, and we're going to be spending the latter half of the session focused more on that, the first half on housing, but her bill will be coming back over to us. So this is, you know, by way of making sure that you have a face-to-face connection and an opportunity to ask questions. So some opening comments from you, some questions from you all, and if we run out of time in terms of the depth, don't worry, we are going to have a real focus on this in the second half of the session.
So, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, and Vice Chair Peluso, for the record, Clyde Psyche, and Interim Director of the Department of Human Services. Just kind of real quick, for those of you who don't know me, I spent the first 23 years of my career at the department, and in 2010 moved over to the Department of Transportation to become the Deputy Director there. And then in September of this past year, 2015, was asked by the governor to assume the position of Chief Operating Officer for the state and Director of the Department of Administrative Services. And actually was confirmed by the Senate in September. And then on November 4th, and I remember the day and the time very well, was asked by the governor to fulfill the role of interim director at the Department of Human Services because of some issues that I'm sure all of you have heard of and seen in the media. And given my background, she asked if I could go over and help stabilize and deal with some of the issues. So I know it's been a long day for everyone, so let me touch very quickly on three things and then be happy to answer any questions. And I'm sure that over time I will have numerous opportunities to come before you and discuss issues further, and also the opportunity to meet with you individually on issues that you're interested in. So the number one priority that the governor laid out for me when she asked me to assume this role is really to get a handle on the child welfare system, and to put systems, processes, to change the culture to ensure that children are safe, whether it be in foster care or in residential facilities, no matter where children in our care are residing, to ensure that we are doing all we can to keep those children safe. There's a lot of work to do in that area. You know, again, I'm sure a lot of you have seen information that Senator Gelser has put out and information in the media. And I would not sit here and tell you that we are in the place we need to be. And my job really is to push as hard as I can and as quickly as I can to improve the safety for kids who are entrusted in our care. And I agree with the governor, that has to be my number one priority. We are bringing in an independent contractor, independent vendor, to do an assessment of the safety of kids in foster care and residential settings. We're actually in negotiation with the contractor and hope to have the contract signed and the contractor on board in the next week or two. The governor has also established an advisory committee, and Vice Chair Stark and Vice Chair Peluso are members of the committee, along with Senator Gelser and Senator Winters. We also have providers who are on the committee, advocates, representatives from the tribes and the African American community, and I think most importantly, we have two members who are actually former foster kids, people who have aged out of the foster care system, who are giving us invaluable, I think, context and insight into what their experience was in the foster care system. And so we're moving forward as rapidly as we can. However, the one thing I've been telling people all along is that really, if people think we can go through a six-month effort and implement the recommendations and be where we need to be, they're sadly mistaken. I think it's going to make a difference and we'll be better for it, but it really is going to have to be an ongoing process. We are going to have to continually look at the foster care system, continually evaluate where we are, what we're doing, and where we need to improve. So it's going to be just a process that literally every day we should be asking ourselves, are we where we need to be, and what do we need to, if we're not, what do we need to do to get us where we need to be? So the second issue I really want to touch briefly on with you is our budget, and several members are members of our Joint Ways and Means Committee and heard the presentation this morning. So if all things stay the same, we're projecting about a $71 million shortfall in our budget for the 15-17 biennium. The shortfall is primarily being driven by increase in caseload and cost per case in our senior programs and our intellectual and developmental disability program. About a year ago, I believe, we implemented a new program under a Medicaid waiver. It's typically referred to as a K-plan. And I think part of the consequence, although we are providing service to more people and a better level of service, one of the unanticipated consequences is the costs have risen to a point where we really don't feel that the program can be sustainable if we keep going as we're going over a period of time. And so Senator Bates, who's co-chair of our Ways and Means Committee, has been working with, I believe, Senator Gelser, Representative Nathanson, and Senator Winters and our staff to really look at what we can do to implement measures that will make the program sustainable. And then the last thing I want to touch on, which I spend time on also, is we are in the process of recruiting for a permanent director for the department. It's been a difficult recruitment to this point in time. And I told the governor when she asked me to step into this position that I would stay there until she was able to find the right person to fill the position. But it's very difficult for an agency when they have an interim director. And I think the sooner we can get a permanent director in and have some permanency for the staff, the providers, and the clients, the better off we're going to be. So with that, let me stop and be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Evans.
I have a comment and again a request. And Director Saki, I've known you a long time. We've worked together on many projects, and quite frankly, you being appointed to this job has helped me in terms of having trust that we're on the right path. So I say that very sincerely. I want to emphasize, though, something I did say during our last meetings when a proposed fix was being brought forward for discussion, and this isn't directed at any particular person, but I have three concerns moving forward. One is I still will need to be convinced why DHS is the size and scale it is, because at some point I think it becomes almost unmanageable just in the sheer scope and volume of people, equipment, resources, materials, requirements. So as you start putting Humpty Dumpty back together again, I need to know so I can explain to my constituents why it is we have one agency that does these things instead of three or four. Second piece is, and this is important at the worker bee level, and it's also important at all levels of decision making, but there needs to be real accountability. And I was concerned by something that was said as a part of the fix before, that accountability was being defined as having additional resources to have oversight to do this, that, and that. And I think that's probably warranted. Mm-hmm. But where I come from, accountability is if you run the ship aground or you break the airplane,
right,
you bought it. And I think that in terms of agency morale and in terms of public trust, those leaders who knowingly didn't necessarily always say the things they needed to say have either been, the perception is they've either been rewarded or hidden, and that can't happen. I say that to say this. I feel, and I know you're not supposed to use the lie word in the building, but in my office on several occasions this past session, first time on this committee, asking specifics about investments of this or that or the other, I often ask agency directors or agency program area managers, is there anything else I need to know? I understand things happen. The agency like yours is going to have all kinds of moving parts. But I don't want to be surprised, and I don't want to be standing here having, on your faith, put money in and finding out, and I was lied to. And I know that is not the way you approach it. But as we move forward, I want to make sure we put systems and structures in place so that the folks that are at the front line who get fired or their contract not renewed as their measure of accountability have confidence that the decision makers up the food chain also have accountability. And in my mind, we can't get Oregon to have the respect and trust of this agency that it should have, because again, 90%, 99% of the time, they're doing good things with necessary situations. It's hard for us to bridge that trust gap if there isn't some measure of accountability that isn't just more money or more oversight. And again, I just want to say you have a Herculean task ahead of you. I'm going to do my best to stay out of it until you guys need more involvement, but
thank you.
I do want to make sure that we have that accountability piece. And again, not after one person or public floggings, but rather a system that is in place so that we can rest assured that when bad things happen,
right,
we don't make the mistake again. And if somebody did it with malfeasance, they're held accountable.
Right. So Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, and Vice Chair Peluso, and Representative Evans. So let me kind of work down the list here real quick. I think what the first point you raised is something that's been debated for years as to what's the appropriate size and what's a manageable size for the department. And during the time I worked in the department, it was really before the split with the Oregon Health Authority, so we were even bigger than we are now. There is a lot of overlap
between the programs. We work with a lot of the same federal agencies. So one of the issues we have is that as if we kind of separate things out further, we really have to maintain that communication and collaboration with each other. So we're approaching the feds in a unified way and dealing with issues in the proper way. So, yeah, I think that the question will be continued to be asked, and is one of the things I'll look at as we go along. You know, to your second point, I guess kind of in my mind, the integrity and credibility of the agency starts with me and the director. And if you can't trust the director or don't feel that the director has integrity, then it's going to be very difficult for you to think that the department itself has integrity. So the way I need to approach it is first of all, I have to act with integrity and be forthcoming and transparent as I deal with all of you. And I have to set that expectation for the leadership team at the department and then have to hold them accountable. And if they're not, then, you know, make the decision that we may need to make some changes. And, you know, the best way I know to lead is to lead by example. And if you're not walking the talk, then it's really hard for you to expect anyone else in the department to behave in that way. So just, yeah, it's...
So you're applying for the full-time position? Or, I trust you to lead it. That would be cool, but I know it's a hard job.
So Chair Kinnegar, Vice Chair Stark, and Vice Chair Peluso. No, I'm not. It's just... it's a difficult decision because having spent time there, I will tell you one of the biggest things for me is that the majority of people, if not most of the people in the department, are very committed, caring, professional people who I will tell you do some of the hardest jobs in state government. When I look at what our Child Protective Service workers do and some of our other people do, I have the utmost respect and admiration for them, and I know that I could not do those jobs. I don't have it in me to do that kind of work because of the difficulty and the things that they see and the things that I know that they take home with them every day. And so my job really is to kind of create the environment, to create the workplace that they can be as successful as they need to be and to try to really work hard to provide the resources and tools they need to do their job.
I wonder if either of my vice chairs who serve on the advisory committee would like to say anything. You've met once already?
Twice.
Would you like to say anything about that process?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, Director Psyche, it has been a pleasure to get to know you and to see your style of work and the standard that you're holding this committee to in a very respectful way. What I've been most impressed about is just a group of open, honest conversation to direct us in the proper manner so that we are doing, again, still remaining focused on what's best for those children growing into adulthood. And the folks around the table are willing to push back, to have the tough questions asked and insist on an answer. And so far, again, too, we have a meeting the 25th, I think it is, coming up. The conversations have been robust, as they say, but incredibly respectful. And I will give a shout out to the two young women who have been in foster care. The grounding and the honesty and the hearing very difficult stories that have allowed to happen for, again, and we're going to figure out why, and we're going to be sure it doesn't ever happen again. I think the folks around the table are committed to see this through for however long it's going to take, even though we do have, you know, we do have a finish line ahead of us. But if we had to extend that, we would extend it. And it has also been very fascinating and very helpful to learn more about the inner workings and to see perhaps where some of the flaws were so that we can work to correct them.
Thank you. You want to say anything? Reserve my comments for my LC concept when it's time because it ties into all this.
Okay. Good. Yes.
So we haven't worked together, and I appreciate that others know you and are building rapport. So I can't speak to whether you have integrity or not. When I was a freshman legislator and Erin Kelly Seal was newly appointed, and she came to my office, had a conversation about how the agency needs more money because DHS isn't working. And my comment to her was, I'm afraid, you know, 30 years ago when we were tied up in the DHS system as children in this state, it wasn't working then either. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine my faith in a broken system that has been broken since I was a child.
Yeah.
And here we are, and I'm an adult now, 30 years later, having this conversation. And when I see things like the Oregonians reporting, I have to assume that they've done some of their homework, that, you know, and I'm going to read a quote. The words "no investigation" appear next to reports of allegations including rape, sexual fondling, children accused of having sex, lack of supervision in the foster care, bruises, death threats. What? Help me understand what is happening in an agency where a culture, this isn't just some one-off employee didn't do their job. This is a 30-year deep ingrained culture of failure to pay attention to these problems. So you can imagine that I'm not necessarily interested in writing you a bigger check to solve these problems. Sure. How do we solve this? Do we take this out of your hands and create something entirely different? And I hate to, you know, pound on you, and I know you're getting a lot in the press and flack, and I appreciate the pressure you're under, so please don't mistake that, but I have a lot of distrust for this agency.
Sure.
Based on personal experience and continual failure, for not just in the last few years, not just under one governor, but we're talking decades of failure. And I don't know how to solve that other than to completely break it and rebuild it. And I'm not necessarily interested in seeing us just say more money will solve this, because more money isn't solving this. I also talk to providers that are good providers out there who are horribly, not beyond embarrassed, it's not even embarrassed, they are horrified that they are now being lumped in with all of this, and people who are doing a good job. And we're not taking best practice from the stars in our foster care system and really using it to leverage us. So, I mean, the one question I really want to know is, how do we have a culture in an agency for 30 years that, how do you fix that culture? What is it going to take? Who needs to leave? It's not, and, you know, firing agency heads, that's great. You can be the governor and say, I got rid of an agency head, we're going to fix the problem. But how many people in 30 years have managed that agency and we still have that problem? That's what has to get fixed. And that's not just firing directors and laying the blame at your feet, sir. It is an absolute culture of a different kind of corruption that is putting children at huge risk. And then those kids age out and are beyond broken. And we did that to them, not just the people who abused them from there. That is the anger that I have when I see these stories, knowing that it's been broken for 30 years, and all I see is agency heads just come and ask for more money.
Mm-hmm. So, Chair Kinnegar, Vice Chair Stark, and Vice Chair Peluso, so, you know, if I ever come and ask you for more money, it will be one of the last resorts. And if I come and ask you for money, I'm going to tell you why I need the money and what the outcome you can expect from that money. I'm not just going to come and say throwing money at the problem is not going to solve it. We've done that for years, and that's not the answer. I also firmly believe that everything, how we've tried to solve the problem in the past, and one thing I've kind of noticed is that what we've done over a period of time is really tried to solve the problem the same way over and over again. And that's obviously has not worked. And so we are at the point, and I think Representative Evans made that point, is that we are really going to have to look at this in a different way. And there may be some pretty drastic things that we have to do. But in getting to that solution, I will tell you that one of my top priorities is that whatever we do, I want to make sure that we're strategic, we have a good business reason, we are going to set up a system that we can measure to see if there's improvement or it's working or not, and that we're going to set up a system of accountability so that the people who are making the decisions and the people who are in charge are held accountable for the performance of the agency. And I will tell you right now, you shouldn't trust me. We don't know each other. Why would you? I mean, I think that'd be foolish on your part. So the only way that I think I can develop the working relationship and get you to trust me is really to have the dialogue with you and to show you and by actions that we're serious about trying to fix what's a broken system.
Can I follow up?
Sure.
Another quote from you, a quote from this week's hearings on the Senate side, I think you're quoted as saying that you are not sure if the children remaining in foster care in our system right now are safe. How do we go back to our communities and talk to voters or talk to our constituents that we know that there could be kids still in the system somewhere that are experiencing these things, and the appearances, we're not getting to them fast enough. How long do we leave them there as we're trying to get our own, system straight, that kids are still potentially sitting in a vulnerable situation somewhere in this state of Oregon?
Well, so Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, and Vice Chair Peluso, there's no other way I could answer that question. I can't guarantee anyone that every kid in our care is safe. It'd be foolish, and I think if I did that, I would be disingenuous, and I would be lying. There's no way that I can guarantee you that every kid in our care is safe. What I can tell you is that we are moving as quickly as we can, and we're not waiting for the end of the six-month report. We've already put things in place to address some of the immediate issues, and every day we talk about what can we do to ensure the safety of the kids in the system. But I just cannot sit here and tell you, then guarantee you, that every kid in the system is safe. I can't do that. And I will tell you, it's one of the things that keeps me up at night. It's one of the things that is deeply troublesome to me. And so that's kind of my charge, is to bring as much improvement as quickly as I can to the system. But I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not going to tell you something that isn't true.
And just a follow-up to that, I appreciate that that's your goal. What are the roadblocks that keep you from plowing through that work? Are there statutes? Are there labor issues? I'd like to know what those roadblocks are so that we can take them out of your way so you can identify these children quickly and solve it. And, whether it's a collective bargaining issue or whatever, or somebody where you have to keep some employee who let 12 years of emails go by and not, identify that. I'm sorry, you need to have an avenue to clean up the culture of failure in your agency. I need to know what that is so we can bring that type of legislation forward so you can fix this problem. And I don't care whose toes we step on to do it.
All right. And I appreciate that. And as many of you know, we've worked very closely with Senator Gelser to try to start removing some of those roadblocks. But there'll be more that we need to address.
So I appreciate the really deep sentiments of these committee members. I don't think you can read those stories and not be utterly disgusted. And I know it keeps us up at night. I know it keeps you up at night. I really want to thank our vice chairs for stepping up and working on that as quickly as you can and take recommendations. And I wish we met year-round because, it's really hard to think that we're going to wait on some of those things to 2017. Senator Gelser has been working incredibly hard to bring there. So she has a 55-bullet list of things that she's working on. And, I don't want it to make it into an either-or with the money or accountability, because we actually do need both. I think part of being in the situation is that we underfund by 30% the residential foster care, and so we have fewer places to place people. But that doesn't excuse the accountability. But I just don't want to make it into an either or. We need to pay properly for quality, and we need to have accountability. And there are a lot of fabulous organizations that are sucked into this, who then look like, everyone's looking at them like, are you doing that too? And they're doing really hard work. So we want to support that. We want to expand that. And I think a lot of her measures are, are there new regulations that actually need to be in place to hold DHS and to hold the providers accountable? And what are the enforcement pieces? And so a lot of her effort is really stepping up the enforcement pieces, including criminal action. I mean, very, very, very strong measures that you will be seeing from that come out of Senator Gelser's bill when it comes over to us.
Chair Kinnegar, though, I would submit that we don't have to wait until 2017. I get that that's the normal timeline we're on. We as a legislative body can call ourselves into a session. the governor can call us into a session. And if the governor, former, would call us in to do a bill for Nike and Intel, I think we can, if we have recommendations that will fix this and not have children unsafely sitting in DHS, I will come in any month of 2016 to do that work. And I think we should put that on the table as a solution and an option to not wait until 2017.
Yeah. So, I mean, 2016, we do have a lot. We want to wait for the recommendations of this. I do want to turn it over to our vice chair who has an LC related to this. And I appreciate that sentiment. I would absolutely be willing to come back to a special session if the your advisory group came up with certain things and it was timely and we needed to act right away. I would agree, but
thank
please.
You. So I do want to throw out that my LC concept, LC 157, I started working on before all this stuff hit the media. Mm-hmm. And the concept is pretty basic. It's a governor's foster care advisory commission. And the idea here, and first of all, before I get into some little bit of the details on this, we wrote the relating to clause very, very broad so it could serve two functions. One, address the commission that I want to get in place. And two, in case as we're going in the next couple of weeks, if we have policy, you know, ideas that we want to get put in right now that we're all agreeing on, that we can slip it in there. Okay, so we have a bill that we're ready to do that if we need to. So the commission, so the governor's appointment of this committee that we were just talking about, we've seen a couple different things. We've seen issues as far as resources, and we've talked about that. There are issues as far as policy, and there are issues as far as culture. All those are different issues, and a lot of those are internal issues. The idea of a foster care commission is basically to say, let's get stakeholders in the community, people who are on an ongoing basis involved with foster care, and see what's going on, to provide an external input into the department. So rather than the department kind of leading what we should be doing and recommending, this is a group that can have accountability with the department and can make recommendations to the governor and to the legislature for policy direction. And as opposed to the governor's committee that we're on right now, which at some point will stop, this is the idea of having something ongoing. I feel like it's something very, very needed that we should really get behind. If you look at some of the similar, as far as how it's formatted, some of the similar committees that are out there, governors appoint a committee on motorcycle safety, economic advisors, fire service policy counselors, physical fitness and sports, long-term care advisory, DUI. We have a lot of these commissions appointed by the governor. And I feel like if there's one area that we really need a commission that will focus in exclusively on foster care and provide oversight and ongoing, for the next 30 years, as Parrish was talking about, ongoing looking at this, external stakeholders looking into it, this is a way we can do it. I mean, these are one of our most valuable assets to our state and our future, our children, and we need to make sure we're taking care of them. Let's do it. So please, everybody sign on to this. I have a handout here. I think it's an OLIS, but for you guys to take a look at. But it's a simple, straightforward concept where we try to get ahead of these issues. You know, rather than wait till something hits the media, we have people dialoguing about the challenges as we go. We're hearing from foster parents in the community and such as we go. And so we can resolve things as we go, as opposed to wait until something's broken, hits the media, and then let's backtrack. So there's my 2 cents. Under before 5 o'clock.
Okay, great. So I'm going to prepare us to adjourn here. I want to thank you for your hard work in trying to turn a really big ship around. It's a really big job, and it's incredibly important. So thank you. Thanks for everyone's input from the committee. We are be scheduled in the short session to meet Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and we have only 5 hearings before bills have to go on to the next committee. And so I'm hoping that people are prepared to stay till 5:30 on the Monday, Wednesday, and Friday the first week, and then we'll let you off the last Friday because our deadline to get it to the next committee is, I think it's Thursday. Anyway, so if you don't mind staying a little extra time in the first 5 and you know, whatever time we would have spent on that Friday, we'll spread out on the first 5 hearings. That'll help us get through some really big agenda
items. Please. Thank you.
Which Friday is that?
So it's the second Friday of the session.
We won't be in.
We will not.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to tell us, Adam?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, no. I think we're all set with okay. 3 different committee times, Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
Monday, Wednesday, Friday, the second Friday, we'll have off, but please be prepared. prepared to stay until 5:30 if needed, the first five.
Things that are actionable.
Okay.
Can't sign on that. We should have that to be as an option so we can come in.
It's the first, third, fifth, and then the next, whatever that is, eighth and tenth.
We tell constituents a lot.
The 12th, the second.
No, we can't get to that.
We can prepare to stay a little later the first few to make up for it.
But, you know, what seems to be important enough is.
All right, so we are adjourned. Thank you.
I teach Tuesday, Thursday.
We are adjourned. Thank you.
I teach Tuesday, Thursday.